Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, February 5th, 2016. So I have been told Happy Black History Month for those who are participating. This is our ninth study session on Edward Baptist, Racist Suspect. His book, The Half, has never been told. We are picking up Chapter 8, The Blood. We ended last week where he was giving additional information. I think we've had two or three sessions in a row that really emphasize how the growth of the banking industry, the credit system, in this area of the world and really globally was directly connected to the enslavement and torture of black people. We're foregoing our normal introduction, just trying to get right to it because we are closing in on the conclusion of the book. I think we're going to have maybe two, three more sessions after this week and we'll be all done. So just trying to power through it so we can get to the next book. But great information, constructive information. I hope folks are learning a lot and applying this to the way that we can solve problems, get a better understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white, and things that we can be doing as victims of white supremacy to solve this problem immediately. With that, we will go ahead and get started. Context of white supremacy. Again, Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, Chapter 8, audio segment number 1.
European and North American economies had been expanding, and people were buying more. But consumers' demand for cotton goods simply could not keep up with this vast an increase in supply. In late summer 1834, the price of cotton at New Orleans was 18 cents per pound. After that, it began to decline, reaching 12 cents in early 1836. Unease with the slow downward trend in prices was beginning to shape decisions at the commanding heights of the transatlantic economy. By late 1836, Baring Brothers, the most influential commercial bank in the world, had been quietly restricting new investments for almost 12 months. And as that year's bumper crop began to reach market, one speculator privately ruminated, "Will prices in Liverpool continue to hold their own? We think not." The White House was also quietly alarmed, in its case, by the dramatic expansion of speculation in public lands. Purchases had reached the figure of $5 million a month in the summer of 1836. In response, Jackson issued the Specie Circular in July, declaring that from August onward, only gold and silver would be accepted as payment for most government-owned lands. Jackson's advisors didn't want him to issue the Specie Circular. It was based on his old-fashioned misunderstanding of the nature of money and credit in a modernizing economy, and it clogged the economy's circulatory system. Heavy gold and silver had to be moved from the East Coast to Indiana and Mississippi and then back again. Land sales plummeted. Banks began to charge a premium for gold and silver, making everything else more expensive. Still, by winter, the flow of money, credit, and goods through the channels of the American economy had begun to adjust to Jackson's friction-creating policy. All other commodities, cotton, consumer goods, and slaves, continued to move on a paper money basis, helped by commercial banks like Brown Brothers of New York, which kept credit flowing to merchants and importers. And that was important, because the entire Atlantic economy now depended on the ability of the planters to cycle cotton revenues back through the system. Yet British textile mills already held high stocks of raw cotton, and layoffs at factories were increasing. Soon consumers would choose to wear their old clothes into rags rather than replace them. Demand for raw cotton was about to crater. The Bank of England, the source of credit for British cotton-buying firms in Liverpool, began to get nervous. In late 1836, it began denying credit to those firms. It took a while for news of this decision to percolate back across the Atlantic. In February, as Martin Van Buren's inauguration approached, a few insiders were quietly coming to realize that this time was not, after all, different. Unless by different, one meant especially disastrous. Against the judgment of others in whom I usually confide, I do not anticipate that the present prices of cotton will be fully maintained, a Washington correspondent warned John Stevens, a principal at the New York firm Prime, Ward & King, which held millions in slave-backed securities issued by southwestern states. Even as Jackson lit his celebratory pipe, a dramatic chain reaction had already begun to ignite. In the wake of the Bank of England's credit tightening, the annualized price of short-term business loans in Liverpool skyrocketed to 36%, making it impossible for cotton brokers to buy even as the full tide of the 1836 crop swept in. Cotton prices began a free fall that only ended in July 1837, when a dead cat bounce took it to 6 cents a pound. In the meantime, collapsing British merchant firms had pulled each other down as they fell. Three of the top seven Liverpool cotton traders closed their doors by the end of February, and Le Havre, France's main cotton exchange, shut down completely. Into the hulls of westward racing ships went bags of letters desperately calling in the mountains of debt owed by American trading partners. As soon as the news reached the Mississippi's mouth, arrays of interlinked debtors and creditors began to cascade down. One after another, in the last week in March, the 10 largest cotton buyers in New Orleans announced that they were insolvent. Some allegedly owed $500 for every $1 that they held in cash or collectible debts. The smaller firms were next. On April 20, the New Orleans Picayune wrote that there were no new failures to announce, for by then, nearly all firms have gone. Shockwaves fanned out across the southwestern states and the frontier and backwashed over New York, where banks shut their doors to prevent runs on their own reserves of gold and silver. By the first week of May, no one in New York could borrow, collect debts, or carry out business at all. In the two most important trading centers of the United States, a state prevailed that venerable former Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin called incalculable confusion. Yet no economic actors were hit harder by what soon became known as the Panic of 1837 than the southwestern banks. They had lent far more paper money than their own reserves of cash justified. Their currency now traded for well under its face value. They faced massive upcoming interest payments on bonds sold on worldwide financial markets. The cotton merchants who owed southwestern banks millions in short-term commercial loans had nothing but cotton, which was selling for less than the cost of transportation. On the other hand, the slave owners who owed the banks money did have tangible property. In one folder of the papers of the Citizens Bank of Louisiana, which had hurriedly dispersed some $14 million in 1835 to 1836, are 19 pages of inventories of mortgaged slaves, listing more than 500 people. And that was only a fraction of those who were mortgaged to southwestern banks, which had lent at least $40 million on mortgage slaves. At the rate of one slave for every $500 of outstanding debt, This meant that 80,000 or more enslaved people were put at risk of another sale by the collapse of commodity prices and the southwestern banks. Thousands more, like the 29 people, Philip, Tony, Caesar, whom Champ Terry of Jefferson County, Mississippi, had put up as collateral for a loan made to him by entrepreneur Nathaniel Jeffries, were privately mortgaged. Working in the fields, sleeping at night, sitting in the quarters while they held a child, every person named on a debt document was under the auctioneer's hammer. If the worst came, wrote one Mississippi enslaver to his North Carolina relative, then an enslaved woman whom they both knew, old Dorcas, would be sold to the highest bidder, because Duncan McBride is in a peck of trouble. Human flesh had proved a liquid resource in times of trouble for many a white person like McBride. Yet in the present crisis, the highest bid would be uselessly low. I heard a gentleman say a few days ago, wrote William Southgate from Alabama, that he saw a Negro fella sell in Mississippi for $60 in specie, which Negro cost something like $2,000. Those who try to dispose of some Negroes to live on, as one bankrupt North Carolina migrant planned to do, found that in many instances they are sold at one quarter the sum given or promised, and the poor debtor left three quarters the sum to be raised from his other property, if such there be. By the summer of 1837, the sudden shift to impotence left white men all across the South anxious and angry. Men accosted each other in the streets, demanding payment for debts. Accusers insisted that banks should open their books. Cashiers cut their own throats. Old men came out west to try to sort out the messes that their sons had made, but dropped dead of strokes when they saw how bad the messes were. When a zealous sheriff tried to press debt cases in Hinds County, Mississippi, local entrepreneurs chased him away and let everyone know that they had laid up a bowie knife for any man who attempts to execute the office. Instead of liquidating debts now, wrote one member of the Natchez banking circle to another in late 1837, everyone should play for time. The debt to the banks in this state must amount to $33 million, but the crop of cotton now growing in Mississippi will net probably $10 millions. Four crop years, like the one now underway, would clear Mississippi planters of debt. This calculation convinced the Natchez man that creditors would rather take delayed payment than call on the collateral. Europe would surely soon want all the cotton Mississippi hands could make, and at a high price. The closing of both Southwestern and New York banks had frozen the financial sector in a kind of induced coma. The temporary shutdown also kept Southwestern banks on life support. The merchant firms of port cities such as Mobile and New Orleans, in contrast, were terminal. Most of these firms never reopened their doors. And there was another problem. When consumers and investors lack confidence that credit will be available, they save too much, turning their fear of deepening recession into a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, during a deflationary crisis, sensible macroeconomic policymakers usually prescribe priming the pump, in which the government's deficit spending encourages private investment. But the federal government had already signaled that it would not take such actions. Martin Van Buren called a special panic session of Congress in the late summer of 1837. He stood by Jackson's specie circular and argued for an independent treasury that would make it impossible for a private bank to use federal deposits to create leverage. His administration did issue new federal debt in the form of treasury notes to make up for the shortfall in federal revenue, which relied on tariff collections and land sales, and thus had declined dramatically with the collapse of trade. But the president refused to underwrite the expansion of credit for the banking system. Yet, in Mississippi, there has been no absolute loss of capital, wrote Stephen Duncan. Enslavers still held the assets, the men, women, and children who produced the commodity around which the entire Atlantic financial economy revolved. But without enough credit to lubricate the circuits of American trade, bales made in 1837 might well sit on the levees and docks until the wind ripped their burlap wrappers into flags. So, over the next 12 months, Southern entrepreneurs asked investors to sink more long-term capital into their region, and to do so on the basis of slavery-backed securities. States and territories on slavery's frontier issued at least $25 million in new bank debt, most of it state-backed, between 1837 and 1839. The world financial community responded. Alabama's state bank attracted massive quantities of capital from the Rothschilds, perhaps the wealthiest family in the world, proprietors of a powerful merchant bank headquartered in London and Paris. The new issue of bank securities, in turn, allowed banks to loan out more money to Southwestern borrowers, which they did. By 1841, the residents of Mississippi would owe twice as much money, $48 million, to the state's banks as they had at the beginning of 1837. In December 1837, John Stevens traveled to New Orleans to take soundings at the disaster's epicenter and to start buying cotton bales for his employer, Prime, Ward, and King. European factories' stockpiles had finally shrunk. The planting states must in a short time recover from the shock of last year, wrote a Southern banker. Van Buren wouldn't come to the aid of the cotton-centered entrepreneurial economy, but other players stepped into the breach. First among them was Nicholas Biddle. After the BUS charter expired in 1836, his home state rechartered it as the Pennsylvania Bank of the United States. Though much reduced in power, the BUSP was still the largest private financial entity in the United States, and Biddle had hoarded its cash reserves through the panic. So now, Biddle attempted the greatest creative destructive play of all time. The BUSP issued millions of dollars in postnotes, promises to pay the holder of the note in a year or 18 months for the face value of the note plus 6%. This was a bet placed by both parties on the revival of the cotton trade. The postnotes would re-monetize the cotton trade and serve as a currency to be traded for the next year and a half, by which time Biddle's revenues from the sale of the cotton he bought would allow him to redeem the postnotes. Biddle and his intermediaries, other high-level commercial banks such as Brown Brothers, provided the state-chartered banks with postnotes on credit. Taking the place of the bankrupt Southwestern merchants, they bought up local planters' crops. The Commercial Bank of Natchez bought $643,000 of cotton for Liverpool on its own account, for instance, while the Planters Bank of Mississippi purchased 60,000 bales of cotton from local planters and shipped the bales to Liverpool. There, Biddle's allies sat on the cotton. Cotton climbed from 9 cents a pound at the beginning of 1838 to almost 13 cents as enslavers across slavery's frontier prepared to plant for 1839. And they planted a lot, because they'd soon need cash. As William Reeves wrote from Clinton, Mississippi, eventually, immense sums have to be made by the sheriffs, and much of it will be made by the sale of property. So enslavers drove their right hands and left hands hard in the summer of 1839. The number of hands I have gathering cotton, wrote A.G. Allsworth in Mississippi, frequently average over 200. And on the fourth instance, they picked as high as 214. Two of them picked a combined 625. James Haywood went into the field and beside his slaves, picked cotton from August to the term because I knew our situation was anxious to be extricated from debt. No overseer would have toiled as I have. When all was said and done, enslavers shipped 1,650,000 bales of cotton in 1839. 225,000 more than in any previous year. But once again, a rise in supply shook the commodity's price, and it started downward. Cotton dropped from a high of 14 cents per pound in the spring of 1839. By September, it was at 10 cents. Once the scope of the vast 1839 crop emerged, the price plummeted all the way to 7 cents a pound. As it fell, it crushed Biddle's BUSP, which had bet everything on being able to redeem postnotes by selling cotton at high prices. The end came fast. On October 9, Biddle's last bank shut its doors. With it fell all the other institutions that had participated in his leveraged bet. Our banks are likely to fall to pieces, wrote Robert Carson, an Alabama enslaver in 1839. The panic of 1839 was an even deeper collapse than the one 2 years earlier. And from this one, most Southwestern banks never reopened. In Tallahassee, when the officers of the Union Bank of Florida ignored a legal judgment ordering them to pay an outstanding bill of $197.23. The court dispatched marshals to auction off its building, the bank's only remaining asset. As the marshals approached the front steps, followed by a crowd of onlookers ready to gloat, the door opened. Officials emerged, carrying sacks of nickels, dimes, and pennies they'd literally scraped off the bottom of the vault. It barely covered the debt. Meanwhile, the money that the Mississippi Union Bank had received for its bonds in late 1838 washed away like a sandcastle when the tide of falling cotton prices came in. One observer predicted that Mississippi will get out of debt about the year of Christ 1897. As it turned out, this was an over-optimistic prediction. Martin Van Buren's presidency had been ambushed by first one panic and then another. Congress, sensing weakness, abolished the president's independent treasury. To the Whigs, the upcoming national election looked like a perfect opportunity to take the White House and unwind the effects of 12 years of Democratic executive dominance. Using the Democrats' own techniques of popular organization and populist message, the Whigs' 1840 campaign depicted Martin Van Ruin as a contradictorily androgynous Casanova who ate from a ballerific gold table service and ordered the construction of a breast-shaped mound, complete with nipple, in the White House garden. They named as their presidential candidate Ohio's William Henry Harrison, who had been born into the Virginia aristocracy, but portrayed himself as a frontiersman and claimed credit for victory over Tecumseh at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811. Pairing him with John Tyler, a Virginia planter who had stayed home in the Old Dominion, the Whigs leaders proclaimed a ticket of Tippecanoe and Tyler too. The Democratic machine continued to turn out votes. Van Buren took almost 47% of the popular vote in the presidential election, which turned out 80% of eligible voters, still the highest ever. But the Whigs swept the panic-devastated southwestern core of Old Hickory support, taking Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, and even Tennessee, hauling in 234 electoral votes to Van Buren's 60. Now in control of both the legislative and executive branches of the federal government, the Whigs immediately forced their first agenda item through Congress. They passed a national bankruptcy law that would allow federal courts to stop chaotic deleveraging and rationalize the process of debt liquidation and financial recovery. Under it, a debtor could relinquish his property to a court-appointed agent who would sell everything and distribute the proceeds to the creditors. After this, the debtor would be legally free of debt and able to restart business. Samuel Thompson, for example, was the member of a New Orleans cotton trading partnership that collapsed in 1839. His insolvent firm, according to the documents he filed, owed more than $400,000, not atypically much. It was, also typically, entangled with likewise flattened creditors, owing $16,000 to the Union Bank of Louisiana, $60,000 to other banks, and even $20,000 for postnotes the firm had borrowed so that it could engage in 1839's last gasp of cotton speculation. The firm, and Thompson, offered a varied portfolio of real estate assets to offset debts. A lot on the corner of Camp Street in New Orleans, half an interest in 1,500 acres on Bayou Black, 1,111 never-seen Texas acres. If creditors insisted on cash, the properties were auctioned to the highest bidder. This is what happened to Thomas, Henry, Peter, and Evelina and her son James, who were appraised at $3,000. Although these five brought only $1,125 on the block, the firm also held $100,000 in receivables, debt others owed to the firm. Smart creditors could pick through these receivables and figure out which ones were most likely to yield value when squeezed, then grab the juiciest ones in return for canceling out the bankrupt's debts. Fully implemented, the Bankruptcy Act might have limited the financial devastation that Southwestern entrepreneurs had brought upon themselves. However, after a month in office, President Harrison, who had contracted a severe cold at his inauguration, died of pneumonia. Now, for the first time, a vice president would succeed a president. Many Whigs assumed that John Tyler, who had, after all, not been elected to lead, would meekly take his direction from Congress. Tyler, however, proved to be mulish in disposition, revealing that he was, after all, essentially a Virginia Democrat. He vetoed the Whig Congress's 1842 bill for a new BUS. The next year, the more Democratic Congress elected at the midterm overturned the bankruptcy bill. Now, all along slavery's frontier, the process of collecting debts from individuals began to roll forward with redoubled speed. All had to fend for themselves against desperate banks, bankrupt merchants, outside creditors, and above all, each other. On every circuit of every southwestern state's court system, judges and lawyers rode on the appointed day to whichever county courthouse was next in the rotation and heard the debt docket. Often, little else in the way of business had happened since the court's last visit, except the filing of thousands of cases. One Alabamian wrote, "Montgomery is completely run down. There is nothing a-doing here but the courts." Lawyers brought protested notes and unpaid mortgages forward. Judges' gavels came down, and clerks issued legal documents empowering sheriffs to seize property for sale. Some debtors were sold out by the sheriff, their slaves and land deeds auctioned from the courthouse steps. Although a great many Negroes will be sold on the block in the course of this and the next session, most expected prices to fall further and were waiting till the thing comes to the worst. Certainly no one paid prices that would actually pay debts from the flush times, especially when measured in gold and silver dollars, the only currency accepted at face value. "I wonder how old Virginia stands the hard times," wrote one Southwesterner about slave sellers who had profited from the rise in asset prices. "I expect Negroes can be bought cheap in the Old Dominion." The Virginians have reaped the benefits of the folly of the Missons, Mississippians, but I think that harvest is over. Slave trader Tyre Glenn came back to collect the $50,000 that Alabamians owed him. In Mississippi, Rice Ballard forced sales and bought the auctioned assets himself. And slave traders were themselves pursued. A letter to Ballard detailed hundreds of thousands of dollars that a dozen slave traders owed to major Virginia banks. The federal bankruptcy court that sold Evelina and James to pay Samuel Thompson's debts did not sell James's father. Despite the separations inflicted by forced migration, the slave frontier was actually teeming with fathers. Indeed, it was full of all kinds of relationships, new, rebuilt, flexible, as creative as the left hand. For fathers, brothers, friends, and lovers, the new relationships of flesh, of blood, and of pretend blood were foundations on which they could stand and feel like men. But relationships were also gateways to more vulnerability. Many enslaved men were more willing to retreat in order to protect their roles as husband and father than they would have been to protect their own bodies alone. One couldn't live out these ties unless one was still alive. Yet achieving survival by sometimes retreating from self-assertion and self-defense required a psychologically difficult sort of thinking about oneself. These conundrums are explicit in what we know of the life of Joe Kilpatrick, a man whose enslaver sold him to a trader passing through North Carolina in the 1830s. Watching him disappear over the southern horizon were his wife and their two daughters, Lettuce and Nellie. Bought near Tallahassee, Joe built a cabin on his enslaver's cotton labor camp. There he took in and raised George Jones, a five-year-old orphaned by the trade. 30 years passed. George Jones grew up. He got married. He fathered two daughters. He named them Lettuce and Nellie. What stories had Kilpatrick told George in their cabin? When did the boy decide that the girls were his sisters? And what does this story of blood that was not blood say about how Joe Kilpatrick decided to live his life? We cannot guess what played in Kilpatrick's mind as he watched a child turn into a man, or as he watched the little girls who bore his long-lost blood daughters' names play in the dirt before his cabin. Yet Kilpatrick registered choice in his actions. He sought redemption for his own losses, not in domination, nor in acceptance of despair, but in long-term, patient hope. This was how he lived out an idea of manhood incompatible with the readiness for vengeance that had long defined manhood, not only for whites in the antebellum South, but throughout much of Western history. Writing about 20th century concentration camps, the author Tsvetan Todorov identifies those few who fought to the death, such as the Jews and communists who rose up against the Nazi occupation of Poland in 1943 and 1944, as exemplars of heroism. The resistance fighters of the Warsaw Ghetto were willing to die for the value of freedom, even if they could not achieve its reality. To the hero, argued Todorov, death has more value than life, certainly more than life under conditions in which one cannot claim freedom. Without the willingness to seek out death to avoid domination, the heroes of the revolts believed life was not worth living. From the tale of Gilgamesh and the Iliad to apocalyptic films, Western epics have been stories about such heroes. They are men who resist, who shed the blood of opponents, who accept no limitations or insults, who will never be slaves. Sometimes they are willing to shed blood and die so that people in general can be free. But always they are willing to do this so that they are free themselves, free most of all from the imputation that anyone could dominate them. Free like Robert Potter. Free like the 20,000 men who came to watch Andrew Jackson become the president. Or free as those men imagined themselves to be. White men, South and North, viewed the alleged non-resistance of enslaved men as evidence that they were not heroes, proof that they were not really men. They mocked black men as cringing sambos and jokes, literature and minstrel shows. The need to disprove the symbolic emasculation that slavery represented has impelled some portion of black cultural creativity for all the years since. And historians have repeatedly confused manhood and resistance when they have written about slavery. Joel Kilpatrick was no hero. He could not construct his life as he would have done in freedom. He was not willing to die just to show he had the freedom to die. Yet he did make choices, and the ones he made were important both for the beliefs about manhood they reveal and for what they did for George Jones, for Lettuce, and for Nellie. Instead of honor, Kilpatrick chose what Todorov called ordinary virtues. Heroes deal out vengeance, wiping out insults and, in an existential sense, denying their own death. In 20th century camps, however, Todorov found some people instead found transcendence by displaying kindness toward other people. Through small, everyday acts that committed them to the survival of other human beings, even at the cost of lowering their own chances, they demonstrated their own commitment to an abstract yet personal value. Although heroic acts were as suicidal in 20th century death camps as they were in 19th century slave labor camps, even in hell, there was still room to be a moral human being. In the slave labor camps of the Southwest, an adult man's commitment to ordinary as opposed to heroic virtues could mean the difference between life and death for children like George Jones. Such choices could have the same result for the men themselves. Rebuilt blood ties could provide a reason not to die fighting in one's chains. Amid the disruptions and dangers of the 1830s, enslaved men frequently became caretakers of others. Caring is not central to most definitions of masculinity. But just as the kindness of enslaved men had breathed life back into Lucy Thurston's soul when her spirit was as dead as a zombie in that Louisiana cotton field, the kindness of men like Joel Kilpatrick led them to create families of all sorts and to care for them, feed them, and teach them. Because these choices placed them in relationships as husbands or lovers, fathers or brothers, these men often made ordinary virtues central to their own identities, despite all the cultural noise that told them that as men they had failed. And perhaps, a man who lived in that way also undermined the white ideal of the man as vengeful hero. Men's pursuit of ordinary virtue in the context of the devastations of forced migration was already visible by the Panic of 1837, shaping life in ways that even influenced the planters' record books. First is simply the rising rate of marriages on Southwestern slave labor camps during the 1830s. At Alexander McNeil's Magnolia, for instance, 21 of the 37 women over the age of 20 were married to men who lived there. Such relationships implied a deliberate choice to start again. Many of these frontier husbands had been married to other women back in the old states. In the middle of the 1830s cotton boom, Peter Carter was sold from Maryland to Florida. An older man by the standards of the trade, over 40, he left a whole family behind. But in Florida, he remarried, in his 50s, and raised 3 more children. Being a husband or father mattered because enslaved men who wanted to live in a way defined by moral choice rather than fear had to turn to the long view, to thinking of the people who would one day be left behind them. Even those who did not marry could establish new ties of blood or pseudo-blood. Charles Ball had left his family behind in Maryland. In South Carolina, he became a contributing member of Nero's household and critiqued Lydia's husband for not being much of a caretaker. Then he adopted a trade-orphaned little boy, the same age as my own little son, whom I had left in Maryland, and there was nothing that I possessed in the world that I would not have divided with him, even to my last crust. What mattered was to matter, to count, to be essential in the life of another person. No need was greater than that of an orphan child for an adult. Except, perhaps, Charles Ball's need for a child. The full fruition of these efforts appeared decades later in the wake of emancipation. Women did amazing things to keep life going during the Civil War, and they pushed for freedom's fullest measure afterward. But in those days, men also made their own sacrifices, some of them brutally difficult ones, to make and remake hundreds of thousands of free households. Nettie Henry's father tramped back from Texas to Mississippi to rejoin her and her mother. Others chose to stay with the people among whom they had rebuilt a life. Jack Hannibal, a man sold decades prior to the 1870s, wrote from Alabama to his North Carolina one-time owner, "Dear mistress, please be so kind to write to Florida to my 2 sisters to let them know where I am, so that they may know where to post their letters." He believed she knew where they had been sold. Then he told her how many children he had, that he'd buried 1 wife and married a 2nd, and that he was ready to gather under his wings all those whom she had wounded. "Please write to my 2 sisters in Florida that, if they are not doing well, they must write to me. For I am now doing like Joseph of old, preparing corn now for them if they should come out." Like Hawkins Wilson, who wrote from Texas to his sister from whom he'd been separated as a little boy to tell her that he'd survived to become a grown man and that, like Joseph, he would be overjoyed to see her again, Hannibal was patriarch and mother hen both. He measured himself by what he had lost, what he had endured, and what he had found again, and not by what he had been unable to resist from enslavers who had called him a boy. What such men got by surviving and caretaking was not always enough to replace the other hopes that they held in their hearts. They paid a psychological cost no one can measure. Nor were all enslaved men exemplars of ordinary virtue. But Joel Kilpatrick, Jack Hannibal, and uncounted others chose to shelter under their wings far-off futures that might only arrive long after their own deaths. They hoped that in that future, children, or children's children, their own blood, would be free. For this future to arrive, however, someone had to survive. In a billion acts of quiet love that kept children and others alive, such men had been challenging Southern white and Western definitions of manhood, even as the boom in planter power swelled to 1837's peak. Once a young Alabama man, told to carry a letter, instead took it halfway down the path to town and then stopped. He made sure no one could see him. Then he buried the envelope in the sand next to the road. The information in the letter stayed in the ground for a month, but somehow his enslaver found it out. The news was coming. Letters and notes from creditors, courts, banks, and sheriffs were all on their way. And there was almost nothing that enslaved men, or the other people in the families they had helped to build, could do to stop the letters from destroying what they had built. There was also nothing John Devereux could do to stop the letters that were coming for his son, Julian. John, who lived in Alabama, was still an 18th century Virginia gentleman at heart. In good Jeffersonian style, he rose on January 1, wrote the number of the new year in both the Christian and the Muslim reckoning, and added a lyrical description of the day's weather. He fed every white man who called at his door. He spent evenings reading works of natural history. At his advanced age, Devereux preferred for Scott Negro to wield the whip. By 1839, however, a maelstrom of failed schemes was sucking Julian under. There was his botched speculation in land claims swindled from Creek Indians. Political enemies discovered the scam and denounced it in the state legislature. Julian's friends shouted down the whistleblowers with threats, but the documents revealed that he owed vast sums of money to multiple banks. His business partnership with brother-in-law Henry Holcomb, a slave labor camp and a Mobile cotton brokerage, collapsed. "Despite our long indulgence," growled a merchant firm's letter, Julian's account remained in the red. A few weeks later, a sheriff's employee brought a document certifying that Julian was being sued for $10,000 by another creditor. More demands rolled in by mail. "Will you make some arrangement for payment? I take the liberty of reminding you of the promises made to me." And, "This bill of exchange on Julian S. Devereux in the amount of $3,500 is protested." Even his marriage was collapsing. Julian sold his land to raise cash and then moved himself and his children, and his remaining slaves, in with John. Julian's divorce from Adeline was a rare event in antebellum Alabama. The legal system believed that only extreme humiliation was sufficient to justify white divorce. John had to claim, in a deposition, supporting his son's divorce petition, that Adeline's propensity to argue, beat house slaves, and wail on the couch when her will was checked had become the notorious subject of general remark and gossip, to the mortification of all her friends. The facade of John's family broke open. Everyone could see the failure inside. Panic strained and ruptured the bonds that had held schemes together, creating a crisis of planter society and manhood that imperiled white social and familial ties in ways that the geographical separations of physical migration had never done. As dawn rose on a ruined financial landscape scattered with useless paper, business very dull here, but few speculations going on, little or no money in circulation, the light revealed once dominating men being pursued like fugitives. They could no longer, for instance, use their pet banks to stand between themselves as borrowers on the one hand and world credit markets on the other. Insolvent slave frontier banks owed massive heaps of debt to northeastern institutions, such as the BUS of Pennsylvania. The BUSP, itself bankrupt, was in the hands of trustees who sent John Roberts down to Mississippi to make collections from the state's banks. But he soon discovered that he had no choice but to try to collect himself the immense quantities of debt that individual Mississippians owed to their planters' bank, which in turn it owed to the BUSP. The condition of the people in their pecuniary concerns, Roberts soon learned, was impossibly tangled. "Even mortgage-secured debts are quite uncertain. The slaves which make mortgage debts most safe are frequently removed and disposed of beyond our reach." The mortgage for a piece of land was recorded at the Woodville Courthouse, he was told. Or maybe it was recorded in Natchez. Or was it Yazoo City? "'Tis all design," Roberts exploded, exasperated at runarounds that circled other runarounds. Everyone, it seemed, was lying and cheating each other in the scrabble to escape the traps they'd built for themselves. "I would not believe the first man in Mississippi," he wrote. "Saint or sinner, there is no difference. They all lie and cheat." Alabama was no better. "The people are getting all most desperate, more shooting and killing each other here than you have any idea of." Soon Roberts was writing, "I would not ask anyone in Mississippi to become security on a bond." He now regarded Mississippi whites as people without ethics, lacking honor, deserving of their suddenly subordinate status in national credit networks. Roberts spent the next 10 years sifting through bad paper and lies, suing hundreds of enslavers and forcing thousands of slave sales. Under that kind of pressure, white proprieties and interpersonal bonds dissolved. "Governor Hiram Runnels owes us money," wrote one of his Mississippi allies, "and he won't pay. He's about to fight a duel and is likely to be slain. Bad news. But wait. Would Mrs. Runnels facilitate you in paying it if he is killed?" Maybe a bullet in a friend's chest was good news after all. As entrepreneurs scrabbled to preserve as much of their stake in the game as they could, even family ties snapped. In 1838, William Thompson and his sister, Indiana, had bought slaves from their brother, Darwin, a gambler in both private and entrepreneurial life, to save him from bankruptcy. Now, in 1842, Darwin wanted to regain possession of them, probably by repaying only part of what they would cost on the open market. But William in Indiana suspected that Darwin would turn around and mortgage the slaves again, as if he held full and clear title to them. He would not keep them 2 years before he or the sheriff would sell them, his sister predicted. In a moment of candor, he had admitted to William that he planned to sell one boy right away. Well, what will you do with the money? William reported asking. Darwin admitted he planned to go to Texas, another country, where he would be sheltered from collection of his Mississippi debts. Of course I retain the boy, William said. That time he managed to protect his own and his sister's financial interests. But when William traveled away for business a few months later, and his wife fell deathly ill, Darwin swooped down to pester her on her deathbed. His sister heard the conversation. I'll tell you what I'll do, sister, Darwin told the dying woman. All I want is my niggas. Give me them. He promised to use their labor to pay his debts. Ha 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 ha, interjected Indiana in her sarcastic account. Everyone knew Brother Darwin was headed far away, leaving creditors to harass his brother and sister. Thus, enslaved people, once the magic seeds of white dreams, became the currency of contention within white families. White Southern women had occasionally raised doubts about slavery. But when pressures caused women to fear not only for family enterprises but for their own individual financial futures, they felt the usefulness of slave property with new intensity. Take Northern Louisiana enslaver Nancy Beeler, entangled with husband Jacob Beeler in the tendrils of their own messy divorce case. Long-standing problems between them had intensified back in 1833, she claimed, when he hit her in the head with a stick. He denied that charge, counterclaiming that she had engineered the elopement of their daughter. Nancy then charged that he had kept a concubine in their common dwelling. Jacob denied all. Nancy vanished and reappeared in her daughter's household, demanding the division of the scores of slaves he owned, regardless of family ties. Jacob could game a public auction, colluding with his friends to keep bids low so he could buy back the undervalued slaves. Instead, she said, appraise the first-rate hands, the women, and the children. Balance them all by their book value so that each spouse would get exactly the same. And split them up, for they are susceptible to a division in kind without injury to us. As the divorce wound on and panics erupted, she stuck to her guns, demanding her share and threatening to get her son-in-law to assault the nearly 70-year-old Jacob. She offered but one concession. She'd let Jacob buy Mary and Colson from her if they fell to her in the division by lot. In an 1835 will, Jacob had given de facto freedom to my slaves Mary Clarkson and her son Colson, a boy something more than 5 years old, both bright mulattoes. Planter women's active support for pro-slavery positions increased dramatically during the 1840s, in both private letters and public writings. Scholars usually attribute this support to a reaction against outsiders' criticism of the South. But perhaps this shift actually grew from the recognition, in the midst of post-panic struggles, of how much right-handed power a Nancy Beeler could get from owning commodified human beings. In the wake of the collapse of the rag empire of banks and bonds, white people cheated each other left and right with such frequency that Southerners came up with the term GTT, a special acronym to denote the tactic. With bankruptcy only a fleeting option, with everyone grabbing for assets, this tactic made a mockery of the law. But it kept enslaved people in enslavers' right hand so they could try again to create empires. And it swept away castles built by the ordinary virtue of enslaved women and men. The acronym requires some explanation. In 1841, as the threatening letters mounted up on his desk, John Devereux's son Julian sought advice. One of his business partners was about to go bankrupt. How, he asked a friend, could he save himself from losing all his property to their mutual creditors? First, the friend replied, do not trust the man. He was probably hiding the truth from Julian and would act to preserve himself without any regard for him. Next, find out how bad the man's debts are. Go ahead and see into the very bottom, deep as it may be, and write me confidentially after you find all out, but don't delay. Finally, get assets from the desperate man. Take papers, notes, Negroes, land, or anything. Things were bad, I really am afraid it is a scrape, but don't be rash about it. So, threaten to move and leave him holding the bag. Tell him you act upon your own desires to square up the business for emigration to Texas, but you need not emigrate after all. Of course, the advice-giving friend, another of Julian's creditors, didn't realize that Julian wouldn't just bluff. Julian had already bluffed him by sending a group of slaves across the Texas-U.S. border and beyond the reach of Alabama's debt collection laws. Shortly afterward, leaving both Julian's wife and many debts behind, father and son Devera headed to Mobile with some of their remaining Alabama slaves. There they boarded a ship for New Orleans and the St. Louis Hotel. After a comfortable and expensive stay in the same building where many New Orleans slave auctions now took place, the white men booked a cabin on a ship headed for Galveston. Any of their slaves that remained unsold went, too, by deck passage. Julian was GTT, gone to Texas. The slaves run off to escape debt were one reason why the enslaved population of the Republic across the Sabine River increased from 4,000 in 1837 to more than 27,000 by 1845. Others took their slaves to a metaphorical Texas. Women sneaked slaves out past vigilant lawmen watching their husbands, delivering them to brothers-in-law who headed to Texas. Slave owners paid overseers to march enslaved people up into the hills overlooking the Black Warrior River until the courts moved on from one Alabama county to the next and left local debt cases alone for a while. In response, creditors struck back, for instance, kidnapping a borrower's slaves, taking them to New Orleans, and turning them into cash on the auction block under the dome of the St. Louis Hotel before a countersuit could be filed. Eventually, Mississippi-based lawyers went to the U.S. Supreme Court to argue in the most tortured and casuistic way that every white man in the state had a right to GTT without even leaving their home county. Written in the wake of Nat Turner, the 1832 Mississippi State Constitution had barred the domestic slave trade, but the state legislature never passed an act enabling the ban, and thousands of Mississippians bought southeastern slaves in the ensuing boom years. Among them was Moses Groves, who went into debt to New Orleans-based trader Robert Slaughter. When the crash came, Groves refused to pay, claiming that the sale had been illegal because it violated the state constitution. No one knows what happened to the specific individuals whom Slaughter had sold to Groves. The scholarly attention focused on the case has been more concerned with the personalities who argued Groves versus Slaughter in front of the Supreme Court. Henry Clay and Daniel Webster represented the slave trader, while Groves's defenders, who were really arguing that all white Mississippians could GTT their debts without having to leave the state, included Mississippi Senator Robert Walker. After taking George Poindexter's Senate seat from him in 1836, Walker had parlayed political power into privileged access to credit, which now meant that he owed thousands of dollars for his own purchases of slaves. His plea for Groves was for the right of individual debt repudiation. On the other hand, Rice Ballard paid Henry Clay's bill. For the great slave trader, this class action case would determine whether he could collect on debts still owed him by Mississippi slave buyers. Several similar cases made it to the Mississippi and Louisiana state Supreme Courts during the first half of the 1840s. And the U.S. Supreme Court delivered for Webster, Clay, and Ballard, rejecting slave buyers' claims that failure to enforce the state constitution gave them the right to cancel their debts by unilateral action. In the environment of intense popular democracy that had emerged during Jackson's presidency, the next step may have been inevitable. By 1840, streams of slave-produced income had dried up. Borrowers could not pay the banks, and sale of their mortgaged property, when it wasn't run off to Texas, brought little cash. The bondholders had fronted the banks millions, and the banks were not making their interest payments. In flusher times, state legislatures had pledged their states, faith and credit, to redeem the bonds. Bondholders and bank insiders began to demand that the states extract the money from the people via taxes. Contracts had been made, just like the one between Slaughter and Groves. If the states went along, as pro-bank politicians often believe they should in order to maintain the ability to borrow in the future, they would have to commit to taxing their citizens at a very high rate. In Florida, for example, the amount owed to the holders of the state-issued faith bonds worked out to approximately $120 per man, woman, and child in the territory, white or black. This meant that the average slaveless farmer would have to pay more in taxes than his farm was worth. In Mississippi, wrote the Columbus Democrat, the beds on which your wives and children sleep, the tables on which you eat your daily bread, will be taken by the excise men for the benefit of those who sleep in splendid brick palaces, who sleep in mahogany bedsteads, eat with golden knives and forks, and drink champagne as the ordinary beverage of the day. Privatizing the gains of investment, socializing the risk. This is a classic strategy for politically powerful entrepreneurs. After generations of struggle to force politicians to respond to them, Southwestern yeomen already suffering from the bad economic times that the entrepreneurial class had created were not about to hand over what remained of their livelihoods in order to bail out rich men. Increasingly, they and their most radical politicians agitated for states and territories to refuse to pay the bonds. Anti-bank anger also split the northern wing of the Democratic Party. Opponents described the reaction as backward-looking, but many voters saw it as a matter of white equality. They want to tell cormorants and sharks, as a Mississippi newspaper called bonders, that rich men couldn't force the public to pay their debts. Wherever the anti-bank Democrats got the upper hand, they launched financial investigations that documented the bank's rampant insider lending and completely irresponsible behavior. It emerged, for instance, that the directors of Mississippi's Union Bank had lent themselves $1 million of the first $5 million generated by the sale of the state bonds. So Southwestern anti-bank politicians now launched a crusade for GTT by entire states. Mississippi Governor Alexander McNutt, the same governor who in 1838 had supported the Union Bank, by 1841 advocated for repudiating the $5 million in state bonds he had helped to sell in the great 1838 to 1839 cotton speculation. In that fall's elections, Mississippi elected a repudiationist majority to the state legislature, which immediately decided that it would not pay the bonds. The Mississippi legislators who voted against paying the bondholders collectively owed between $500,000 and $1 million to the Union Bank. Those who voted against repudiation owed about half that amount. Both Florida and Arkansas also repudiated their bonds. Louisiana technically did not repudiate its bonds, but Democratic legislatures refused for years to make interest payments on CAPL, Union, and Citizens Bank bonds. The state had committed to back $21 million in bonds. Banks sold the securities and lent out the proceeds to their friends. Yet, as of the Civil War, $6 million remain unredeemed, the interest still unpaid. Bond repudiation outraged investors. Outrage fermented quickly to contempt. When he traveled to New York in 1839, John Knight discovered that Mississippi and Mississippi men, bank, and sea already stood in horrible odor. Wall Street's banks had survived the Panic of 1839, effectively winning the battle with Nicholas Biddle and the Southern entrepreneurs for control of America's financial future. But Wall Street men and City of London types alike were shocked that the Southwestern frontier, in which they had invested so much money, would so shamelessly steal. European bondholders fired off endless pamphlets criticizing the repudiating governments. The London Standard called Mississippi citizens a set of atrocious scoundrels. The London Times claimed in 1847 that it would be 50 years until another European would be fool enough to lend money to the United States. The bondholders launched endless lawsuits. Despite a withering storm of criticism and lawsuits, however, the bankrupt states continued to refuse to pay. The U.S. Supreme Court dodged involvement. As late as the 1930s, the Principality of Monaco, which had inherited some Mississippi Union Bank bonds, was still trying to sue Mississippi in the Supreme Court. And Congress also declined to act. Neither party wanted to demolish its own electoral chances in the half-dozen repudiating states. The state citizens, meanwhile, solaced themselves against the slings and arrows of an angry financial world in a number of ways. Less wealthy whites took satisfaction in the discomfort of bank cliques. The governor of Mississippi and some of its leading newspapers turned to an ancient Western excuse. A Mississippi newspaper dismissed the London Times as the organ of Jew brokers, while Alexander McNutt sneered that the Rothschilds, who held both Alabama and Mississippi bonds, should be denied payment because they were of the blood of Shylock and Judas.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment, all done. We will pick up there for the second audio segment. We are still in chapter 8. I think we will finish this chapter up during the second audio segment. As I said, we are on the home stretch, almost there. If you have comments you would like to share on the first audio segment, feel free to chime in. The number to dial, 741. Wait a minute. Oops. Got confused. Sorry. Number 641. 715-3640. That number again, 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The code again, 564-943-pound. If you want to participate but you don't want to use your phone to dial in, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you're not there, the address you can use is tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put that address in, you'll see a link on the left side of the page. It says free VOPE line. When you click that link, it will open a tiny window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, you can use a nickname, you can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. If you'd like to participate, it is the same procedure. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do so, I'll see your hand on the switchboard and we will get you on the line. That's it. Feel free to chime in. There were a couple points that popped up where I had questions. I'll ask those after folks get their commentary in. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up should be with us. I think we have one of our female callers in New York, Mr. Demery 4, Thomas in New York, and Roz. All four of you should be with us. I reckon we'll start our female caller in New York. If you wanted to go first, feel free. Unless I have it incorrect, you should be with us. Caller at, is it 4223? 4223. Did you?
Greetings. Hello. This is Misunderstanding.
Oh, greetings.
It's Florida.
Oh, right on. Florida, my bad. My apologies.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. First, I want to say thank you so much for the book study session. I really appreciate the sessions. I don't get to do a lot of live sessions, but I try to check in on the archives and catch up. So thank you. And greetings to all of the callers and to Justice. So I didn't take a lot of notes. I just kind of listened, and a lot of things that stood out, well, the main thing that stood out was just violent behavior, violent behavior. Amongst one another, and let's see, the John, no, Julian Devereaux. Julian Devereaux. He was. I just noticed that he was very manipulating and conniving. I guess along with all the rest of the men that didn't want to pay their debts. But it was really funny that he reached out for, you know, for advice to the very creditor that he was gonna, that he basically used that advice that he received against the creditor and skipped out on him. That was quite interesting behavior. Let me see what else stood out for me. And right now, that's all I have. I'm really, really enjoying it. I didn't have a lot, but right now, that's all I have. So I will mute my line. Thank you for taking the call.
For sure, for sure. Other folks who had hands up, Mr. Demery Ford, Thomas in New York, Roz, if y'all have commentary, feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers. It's Demery Ford from the DMV area. What I found interesting was even back on page 85, they were talking about creative destruction and capitalism and this strategy that whites was using to first cause destruction with a strategy to come back later and to profit upon. The book mentioned Vincent Nolte, who first showed up as a representative of the Anglo-Dutch firm Hope and Company, bringing in £500,000 to New Orleans to accumulate huge piles of cotton, cornering almost 10% of the market. And he was getting his backing from the Bank of England and the Baring Brothers. Now, these European investors and bankers was backing him. And these people, you know, had been in the banking industry for hundreds of years and was investing in all types of things, including opium grown in India and sold in China, and the United States included in that illegal activity even later. But the question in my mind is why Andrew Jackson would wanted the Bank of the United States killed or destroyed when he was doing business with the Bank of England, the Baring Brothers, and other European investors that was injecting millions to pay Nolte and his peers, which included Andrew Jackson as one of Vincent Nolte's peers. So it just seems like the president was mortgaging the financial future of the United States with these European investors. And although Europe had banned the slavery trade, they still hadn't diversed, you know, from backing slave-backed securities and mortgaging slaves to the southwestern banks. So this whole game of credit and the bankruptcy laws could be manipulated, and just like they're done even today. It looked like Europe stockpiled a lot of cotton and then held it to intentionally for the price of cotton to go down. And then upon any reemergence, they could still manipulate the market and probably take the biggest gain on it. And like the female caller commented early on this, Julian Devereaux, who was John Devereaux's son. Now, this guy was rich, and he had blotched speculation in land claims. He had swindled land from Creek Indians, misused credit, owed vast sums of money to various banks, was being sued personally for over $10,000. His marriage was wrecked. And, I mean, the guy had free labor. He was rich to begin with. And he still couldn't make it in a system designed for white people, as himself. So I think it was a brief mention of the slave ship, the Creole. I hear background noise.
I think it was just echoing on somebody's line, but should be straight.
Okay. Yeah, and I think that ship was portrayed in one of your Facebook posts, but, you know, colorful picture of slaves mutinying, overtaking a slave ship, and they had a successful revolt, you know, which led to 128 enslaved blacks being freed. You know, what it looks like is happening is a lot of things is starting to work against these enslavers, and least, maybe not the least, but many of the enslaved men were willing to retreat in order to protect their roles as husbands and fathers, you know, which is quite understandable. You're in a situation like Mr. Nellie Fuller said, you're a prisoner of war. You've been captured, you know, so, I mean, what else is it to do but comply, although there were resistance, but white men in the South and the North viewed any alleged non-resistance of enslaved men as evidence that they were not heroes and proof they were not really men. You know, it just goes to show the warped psychological and pathological thinking of white people. And then another thing is the white women, when the guy was being divorced from his wife, she wanted half the slaves too. So, you know, we have to always be mindful of the deliberate and cooperation white women had in the torture and mistreatment of black slaves. And then the book mentioned women and men did amazing things to keep their life going. During the Civil War, families being broken up and being sold off and having to make and remake families, hundreds and thousands of free households. And then these scoundrels, after they misused their debt, mortgage, and slaves, and land, would resort to a tactic of GTT, which is an acronym for Gone to Texas. So they run off to avoid their debts, and some even stashing their slaves to come back and sending them off ahead of time and meeting up with them later. I'll mute my line, give somebody else a chance. Thanks.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For let's see, Roz Thomas in New York. Someone dialed in from a block number. You should all be with us. I think there might have been folks having some difficulties with the live stream. For people just listening online at Black Talk Radio Network or tune in, should be corrected. If you want to listen in there, you certainly can continue on the phone, but should be straight if you are listening at tune in or just online at Black Talk Radio Network. Other folks that we haven't heard from, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to all the callers. I just thought about what Mr. Demery Ford just talked about in reference to the people who owed their debts, stashing their slaves. In some cases, it sounded like Mexico or parts of Texas that were inaccessible. And it just reminds me of today with all of the different companies that avoid paying their taxes by stashing their money in Swiss bank accounts or in the Caribbean in banks where, you know, they won't get taxed by the United States government. So it just made me think of that in that split second. But also, listening to the person reading the book, I remember last week you had talked about the fact that they had changed the word. And I noticed he did it about twice in this reading, too. It was very small, but I caught it because I had to do a double take because I was actually reading the words as he was saying it. And I forget what paragraph, but there was one where it started off and it said they, and in brackets it had the Virginians, and it had the word Virginians in there. And then he didn't say it that way. He actually said the Virginians, when it actually said they and put the Virginians in brackets, as in basically they, meaning the Virginians, was what was implied. But he read it as if it was a straight sentence, and I said, wait a minute. And then he did it again with something else, and I thought about last week when you brought that up. But I found that this was a pretty fascinating read this week, this first portion. On page 280, there's a paragraph that says the federal bankruptcy court that sold Evelina and James to pay Samuel Thompson's debts did not sell James's father. Despite the separation inflicted by forced migration, the slave frontier was actually teeming with fathers. Indeed, it was full of all kinds of relationships, new, rebuilt, flexible, as creative as the left hand. For fathers, brothers, friends, and lovers, the new relationships of flesh, of blood, and of pretend blood were foundations on which they could stand and feel like men. But relationships were also gateways to more vulnerability. Many enslaved men were more willing to retreat in order to protect their roles as husband and father than they would have been to protect their own bodies alone. One couldn't live out these ties unless one was still alive. Yet achieving survival by sometimes retreating from self-assertion and self-defense required a psychologically difficult sort of thinking about oneself. And I found that that was really telling because it just made me think immediately of Dr. Welsing. And I look, every time he says self-assertion, I think black self-respect. Like that's exactly, every time he says it, that's what comes into my mind immediately. And it just really gives a understanding of the concept of black self-respect being like the major key to our liberation in all the different ways that Dr. Welsing referenced it, as far as her saying, speaking about us not killing each other, not backbiting one another, all of the different things that she brought up. This really speaks to that in a very profound way. And also, when he said that it required a psychologically difficult sort of thinking about oneself, really goes to the psychology, really the importance for white people in practicing racism, white supremacy against non-white people, but most intensely against black people, the ability to get into our psyches and get into our soul. It's like the worst form of breaking a human being ever. And this really alludes to that. And I just found it really telling because I immediately thought of Dr. Welsing upon reading that section. And then there was a section on the following page where I thought the author was practicing racism. That section on page 281, it says, writing about 20th century concentration camps, the author, Zvetan Todorov, identifies those who fought to the death, such as Jews and communists who rose up against the Nazi occupation of Poland in 1943 and 1944 as exemplars of heroism. The resistance fighters of the Warsaw Ghetto were willing to die for the value of freedom, even if they could not achieve its reality. To the hero, argued Todorov, death has more value than life. Certainly more than life under conditions in which one cannot claim freedom. Without the willingness to seek out death to avoid domination, the heroes of the revolts believed life was not worth living. From the tale of Gilgamesh and the Iliad to apocalyptic films, Western epics have been stories about such heroes. They are men who resist, who shed blood of opponents, who accept no limitations or insults, who will never be slaves. Sometimes they are willing to shed blood and die so that people in general can be free, but always they are willing to do this so that they can be free themselves. Free most of all from the imputation that anyone could dominate them. Free like Robert Potter. Free like the 20,000 men who came to watch Andrew Jackson become the president. Or free as those men imagined themselves to be. And in the following paragraph it says, white men, South and North, viewed the alleged non-resistance of enslaved men as evidence that they were not heroes, proof that they were not really men. They mocked black men as cringing sambos in jokes, literature, and minstrel shows. The need to disprove the symbolic emasculation that slavery represented has impelled some portion of black cultural creativity for all the years since. and historians have repeatedly confused manhood and resistance when they have written about slavery. I found those two paragraphs extremely telling, and it seemed to me that because earlier he had discussed different instances in which black people did stand up for themselves and assert themselves when being mistreated by white people. But yet in that first paragraph, he alluded to all of these white people as if these white groups and white people as if they're the only ones that were willing to die for their freedom. And it really kind of, in my thinking, kind of negates, because it's so late in the book, it's negated in my mind, an attempt to negate the things that he discussed earlier in the book, in which he showed prime examples of black self-respect. So I found that to be an act of racism being practiced there. And then in the following paragraph where he talked about white people mocking us, I find that very interesting, that when you strip someone down to a level beneath that of animals, where you treat a dog better than you treat a human being, and as a result of the psychological damage of that terrorism, they begin to live out the reality of what you've inculcated those people with, and then you seek to mock them, to further belittle them from the status that of which the place to, that which of which you brought them to through terrorism and genocide, really speaks volumes to the psychology of white people, and to me the psychology of the author as well, just in putting those words together in that fashion. Also, I felt he was practicing racism on the following page, too, in the way in which he was discussing definitions of black masculinity. He said, in slave labor camps of the Southwest, an adult man's commitment to ordinary as opposed to heroic virtues could mean the difference between life and death for children like George Jones. Such choices could have the same result for the men themselves. Rebuilt blood ties could provide a reason not to die fighting in one's chains. Amid the disruptions and dangers of the 1830s, enslaved men frequently became caretakers of others. Caring is not central to most definitions of masculinity, but just as the kindness of enslaved men had breathed life back into Lucy Thurston's soul when her spirit was dead as a zombie in that Louisiana cotton field, the kindness of men like Joe Kilpatrick led them to create families of all sorts and to care for them, feed them, and teach them. Because these choices placed them in relationships as husbands or lovers, fathers or brothers, these men often made ordinary virtues central to their own identities. Despite all the cultural noise that told them that as men they had failed, and perhaps a man who lived in that way also undermined the white ideal of the man as a vengeful hero. I thought that he was practicing racism there because, as far as I understand, those things that he claimed were not ordinary. What was the term he said? Caring is not central to most definitions of masculinity. I don't know of anyone who's a part of any sort of family or attempted family, or even white people for that matter, who don't show some form of caring at some point for the people that they relate to or have that attempted family relationship with. And that's part of being a man, is being able to raise the next generation and to teach them and to give them information and to also be a nurturer, as well as to be that assertive adult to set boundaries and rules. So I found that very interesting, that because of the way that black men were forced to only express those aspects of their masculinity, which in the white mind is feminine, just due to their cultural makeup and their Yorugu cultural mindset and Asili, I just found it to be an act of racism the way that he belittled that aspect of black men expressing themselves during a time of terror like that. Also, I found it very interesting on the following page. It said, being a husband or father mattered because enslaved men who wanted to live in a way defined by moral choice rather than fear had to turn to the long view, thinking of the people who would one day be left behind them. Even those who did not marry could establish new ties of blood or pseudo blood. Charles Ball had left his family behind in Maryland. In South Carolina, he became a contributing member of Nero's household and critiqued Lydia's husband for not being much of a caretaker. He then adopted a trade orphaned little boy, the same age as my own little son, whom I had left in Maryland, and there was nothing that I possessed in the world that I would not have divided with him, even to my last crust, is a quote from him. What mattered was to matter, to count, to be essential in the life of another person. No need was greater than that of an orphan child for an adult, except perhaps Charles Ball's need for a child. And I just found that really telling, just the fact that that the author focused on that aspect of Charles Ball's life and just how we were fighting so hard to try and keep some semblance of family and some semblance of being recognized. It made me think of The Invisible Man, that whole section, just the idea of not being seen, not being recognized as a human being or having any respect for my life in any capacity as a Black person. And it just really says a lot for what our ancestors had experienced trying to deal with racism, white supremacy. There was another area. Oh, yeah, this was really interesting. I think Mr. Demery Ford brought it up. But there's this short paragraph that speaks to white women. It says, Planter women's active support for pro-slavery positions increased dramatically during the 1840s. In both private letters and public writings, scholars usually attribute this support to a reaction against outsiders' criticism of the South. But perhaps this shift actually grew from the recognition in the midst of post-panic struggles of how much right-handed power a Nancy Beeler could get from owning commodified human beings. And this really spoke volumes to the fact that he did it in a really subtle way, using the term right-handed, but it really speaks to the violence that white women are capable of. And like Mr. Demery Ford said, their dedication to the system of white supremacy. I believe on the last reading, I discussed listening to Dr. Welsing, I forget, I gave the number of the episode because I've been listening to them all back to back, where she discussed white women essentially being the root of white supremacy because they are the first teachers, the first nurturers of white male and female children, and that paragraph stood out and spoke volumes in regards to that. Also, there was the final thing I wanted to talk about, there was a paragraph on 288 that I found extremely telling. It says, slaves' runoffs to escape debt were one reason why the enslaved population of the Republic across the Sabine River increased from 4,000 in 1837 to more than 27,000 by 1845. Others took their slaves to a metaphorical Texas. Women sneaked slaves out past vigilant lawmen watching their husbands, delivering them to their brothers-in-law who headed to Texas. Slave owners paid overseers to march enslaved people up into the hills overlooking the Black Warrior River until the courts moved from one Alabama county to the other and left local debt cases alone for a while. In response, creditors struck back, for instance, kidnapping borrowers' slaves and taking them to New Orleans and turning them into cash on the auction block under the dome of the St. Louis Hotel before a countersuit could be filed. I found that to be extremely telling. I used to run the streets in New York City during the crack era, and I thought about this, and I said, he's talking about them fencing Black people. And they literally are discussing kidnapping Black people and fencing them before a countersuit could be filed. And they're basically fencing human beings, just like someone would steal jewelry and fence it on 125th Street. It was the most incredible thing. It was so innocuous when I first read it, and then it just stood out to me like a red light. And it just really speaks to the origins of some of the criminal activity that we see today and some of the things that we deal with. Just like before, I talked about rap artists selling tapes out of their trunks and making quite a bit of money, and basically white people selling Black people basically out of the trunk. While they would be traveling, they would sell Black people. So this is just something else that stood out as far as them fencing Black people, and it just speaks to the psychopathology of white people. Thank you for taking my call.
Right on, right on. Let's see. Any of the folks that we have not heard from, Thomas in New York, a person that dialed in from a block.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Doc. Good evening to all the callers. I just wanted to make a few comments. GTT. Man, that was like the first, I think it's called Chapter 11, is it? Or Chapter 13, where you go bankrupt. But, you know, they were smart. You know, when they can't get, when people couldn't get paid on their slave back securities anymore, it was like, honey, get the kids, get the slaves, let's go to Texas. And, you know, they came up with clever schemes to get out of town using the innocent white women to help them. I like how this chapter also showed the white women trying to own slaves. White women becoming able to sue. I think someone else alluded to this, or maybe everyone else did. But they wanted half the property. They wanted half the slave. They knew where that was, where the money was. And, it sounds like that this was the premise of court today. You know, the woman gets half, I guess. But in the cases they mentioned in the book specifically, it seemed like both the, or might have been two or three cases they mentioned where the women wanted a divorce or whatever. All three cases or two cases, they said that it had something to do with a concubine. So, you know, they had a problem with their husband having a concubine of these black women. So I felt that was kind of interesting. And I'm glad Mr. Demery mentioned the opium trade, because when we started reading this book, I believe that the creditors down in New Orleans, their name was Billings. I don't have the book, but I think that was their names. And when I did some research on them, they were a huge part of the opium trade at the same time. They were like just kind of mirroring that at the same time. So I was glad he brought that up. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Right on. The caller from a block number, did you have commentary you wanted to add? Person that dialed in from a block number, did you have commentary you wanted to add in? Maybe they're waiting for later. We will see. If you have comments you want to get in before we get to the second audio segment, we should have ample time. Some of the things that stood out, even kind of at the very beginning of the segment where we picked up this week, still in all of this is Chapter 8, The Blood, where they wrote out that banks had lent $40 million on mortgaged slaves. He generally lists when he has converted the figure to, you know, like 21st century currency. So I'm assuming this is like, you know, 19th century, $40 million on enslaved black people. Like, it would take me a second. Like, I can get the conversion. But I mean, that is like a gargantuan figure. Like, to start putting that in terms of what that means in terms of the total number of black people and just the worth, the entire economy being based on tortured, terrorized, shackled black folks. I mean, it's staggering. Moving forward, some of the other things that stood out where, let's see, the portion where they start talking about black people and resistance. It was especially interesting. I think I mentioned last week the American Slave Coast. The authors, they're also white. They will be on the program this coming Monday. But these two books, they nicely coincide because they're pretty much talking about the same period of time. And they have some similar main themes in terms of black people representing money, the bank, if you will, for racist man, racist woman, racist child, and then the essential nature of rape. That book, The American Slave Coast, focuses a lot more on rape, forced rape, and breeding and really that linking that with the banking, that hey, if we can rape these black females and, you know, get them to produce more children, that's just more money, more money, more money. And even thinking like, okay, so if I rape her and then I rape her children and then great grandchildren and boom, boom, boom. And just already doing the math on how that's, you know, adding to my wealth. My estate is increasing with each rape, each pregnancy. I mean, it's astounding. But with that text, there are so many incidents, and it's in this book too. There are so many instances of slave uprisings and black people killing white people. He also goes into a lot of detail, just like this book, the Haitian Revolution. He mentions the Stono Rebellion in South Carolina. He devotes time to Nat Turner, Gabriel Prosser, and some of the ones that we talked about here. 1811, I think that was at kind of the very beginning of the book, where I think we suggested that we think they might have lied, that I think they only suggested that it was maybe two or three white people killed, and they were saying that it was a marauding group of black people who were going and killing whites. This was before Louisiana was even a state in the Louisiana Territory at the time, at the beginning of the 19th century. I found it fascinating that he would cite examples from Nazi Germany and saying these Jews and Poles who fought back against the Third Reich, that these are examples of heroism, just as Roz said, but not citing Nat Turner, the Haitians. They don't get mentioned at all. I mean, even from this book, it's not like he doesn't mention any of these people. He could have just cited them from earlier in the book and said, oh, yeah, these are heroes. You did have ample examples. I think I even said, I questioned, because I think it was in the very first reading where he said that there were comparatively few examples of black people resisting and having uprisings, rebellions, killing whites during slavery. And I think we questioned then whether that was accurate, and that might have been an act of racism on his part. And it's pretty in my view, it is a widespread act of racism, where whites greatly diminish the numbers of revolts and times where black people resisted racism, white supremacy, by killing white people. The portion where he talks about the psychological ramifications, I thought that was fascinating. Black people do not qualify for black mental health. Dr. Frances Cresswells, and she said that again. Even the passage where he says enslaved men were more willing to retreat in order to protect their roles as husband and father than they would have been to protect their own bodies alone. I have heard that mentioned quite a few times before, where one of the ways that racists would try to minimize the likelihood of enslaved black people absconding and trying to run away or even having an uprising was to get them in a quote unquote family, have some sort of arrangement where they would be less likely to leave. Now you're tied that. I think even some of that is depicted in Alex Haley in the movie, where, okay, once we get this person matched up with somebody else and they have some children, even though I could sell them anytime I feel like it, or rape them, or whatever else I want to do with them, that might make them a little less likely to leave. They might be a little bit easier to control, which, again, I think, as Roz pointed out, just points to the level of psychological torture that goes into all of this. And just let me think of anything that I can that will make you easier to control and terrorize, just the depths of pathology. I'm going to come back to the portion where he talks about the manhood, because I had a few questions about that myself. I thought that was a pretty intriguing paragraph, the way that it was written out. Although, before he gets into this long thing about how black people were mocked and all that, he mentions our guy again, Robert Potter. I think that's 2-3 weeks in a go. People don't remember. This is the guy down in North Carolina who castrates not just one, but a couple white guys, because he thinks they've had an affair with his wife, because he's not going to be emasculated. And I think he even made up some new terms last week. Potteresque, I think, was one where he had several references where he just keeps bringing this guy up. I don't know what that is in terms of why this guy is so significant for castrating genital focus. I don't know why he holds such significance for Mr. Baptist, but I did highlight that, in particular that him being listed alongside Andrew Jackson. Like, these are the specific white people that he names in terms of these are supposed to be representative of white masculinity. Andrew Jackson, someone who, by his own word, committed to genocide against non-white people, and going out and doing everything I can to kill and maim and many non-white people, so-called Indians, and take their territory. Black people own slaves, whatever. I don't care. I'm a total gangster for racism, white supremacy. This guy, Robert Potter, I'm castrating and chopping off penises of other white men who have done me wrong. That is fascinating. And I'm not even disagreeing with him. In terms of these seem to be the type of whites that are revered, that they say are representative of what it means to be a white man in a system of white supremacy. I'm just noting that these are the folks that he mentions before going into this paragraph talking about black masculinity. You can even relate that to my man, American Sniper, Chris Kyle, and him urinating on other soldiers and his tally for going out and killing whites, if you need a 21st century version of either of these individuals, Robert Potter or Andrew Jackson. I'm going to come back to that paragraph because I have a question about that that I'll ask the folks that are listening in. Some of the other things that stood out. Just again, I think we talked about this before. This has been a major pattern in terms of anytime whites where they try to lie and give you the sense that whites are cultured and civilized and blacks are depraved and we are culturally inept and it's something wrong with us and, you know, we steal and have all the... Man, nobody has whites beat in that department at all. And I mean by their own record where they're stealing and cheating other whites. My man says, I don't care who it is, saint, sinner, they're all stealing and cheating and lying. And it's every single one of them. And that's come up repeatedly. The dueling, that's come up again this week. That's in the other book, American Slave Coast as well, where it's every... And it, again, it's the governor. It's not, you know, some vagabond. It's not some poor, you know, homeless peasant who is out doing it. It'll be the governor. It'll be Andrew Jackson. It's in there listed as someone else who is participating out dueling somebody. I'm upset. We were gambling. We were at the card game or what have you. We were at the brothel and I got upset. He called me a dame. Just total savageness on every page. Yeah, there was Governor, where it says Governor Hiram Runnels owes us money, wrote one Mississippi ally, and he won't pay. He's about to fight a duel, and he's likely to be slain. So this might be a good thing. Maybe we can get his wife to give us some of the money. Let's see. Yeah, I thought everything about it. I think Mr. Demery said the whole system is set up for them, and these people still cannot come out and be quote unquote successful and make this work, where they're still piling up massive debts, where they've got all this free labor, and the whole system is designed for them to do well. I thought the whole GTT fascinating, white people fighting and scheming with one another, which again just shows the savageness that Ben Tillman talked about. If you scratch a white person, that savageness is going to be there just beneath the surface. The passage where he said everyone knew Brother Darwin was headed far away, leaving creditors to harass his brother and sister, thus enslaved people once the magic seeds of white dreams became the currency of contention with white families, where you have white people arguing and bickering. I point this out all the time. White people do not like other white people. This is not about liking anybody. They would be brawling and feuding with themselves if they did not have non-white people, particularly black people, to take out all of their pathologies and aggression, terroristic tendencies. And it just continues with the next paragraph where it says that where Nancy, I guess, Beeler, I think is how he's pronouncing her name, where she and her husband, Jacob, where they're arguing and brawling. She's upset because he has a concubine. It wasn't mentioned explicitly, but it just reminded me of the whole segment that we talked about last week about raping black people, where I just assumed that this was a non-white person, probably a black female, that was a part of the disintegration of this marriage. And then they argue and bicker about how they're going to divide up the Negros with the dissolution of their marriage. I thought that was done in a really diminished capacity, where the role of white women in all this has just not been a focus at all in this book. I would be curious if some of the white people, white scholars who read this book, if they have a critique of white women not really getting much attention in this work, which tends to be the way that we talk about and think about slavery. Even I won't just say slavery. It tends to be the way that we talk about and think about racism, white supremacy on up to 2016, where this is the man, racist man, where it's not white women, where I thought he just gives this very short sentence talking about Planned Women's active support for pro-slavery positions increased dramatically during the 1840s. He doesn't really give any names. He doesn't give any details. It's just a really short snippet and then moving on with the rest of our story. Let's see where the kidnapping and all of that. I mean, I cannot even imagine. You're a black person. You've been enslaved. You're in, you know, Louisiana, Alabama, wherever you happen to be. You've got some, you know, thug, racist, quote unquote owner And T has messed up his credit and everything. And so, hey, you are the money. You are what the bank is coming to repossess. And so it's, hey, you know, you're going to be shipped off. You're going to walk. It's not like we're putting you on a train, right, or a car. So you're going to walk 500 miles to, you know, where we can stash you at. In Texas. And then it's where it says the creditors, they find out this scheme is going on where they're trying to hide the niggers so that we can't get our money back. So we come and kidnap. The creditors are coming to kidnap enslaved black people so that they can get them. I mean, I cannot imagine the impact that this has on the black people that are going through all of this, where you're just a hog, you're just a sheep to be stolen to pay off my debt, card game, bad crop season, whatever the case may be. You know, sorry, Tom, got to be sold, or sorry, you got to be kidnapped, or sorry, you got to go hide out in the bushes for the next week until we can abscond to Texas. It is, just incredible. Cannot even begin to imagine. Let's see, is that everything I wanted to get before I go back to that? Okay, yeah, I think that's most of the main things I wanted to get. Now I can go back to that paragraph that I think a lot of folks had some thoughts about. Before I get to my question, the passage I cannot emphasize it enough, where he says that whites mocked black men as cringing sambos in jokes, literature, and minstrel shows. That should be put like side by side. Them doing this, and I mean, this even continues today, right, where you hear white people and a significant number of victims saying that black people, you know, Trayvon Martin, Renisha McBride, this keeps happening because you take it. Y'all don't stand up and do anything. You're not men. You're not women. If that happened to my child, if that happened to my son, or, you know, whatever, my wife, my husband, you know, it'd be smoke in the city. I would have shot somebody or killed somebody or whatever the case may be. There'd be blood in the streets if that happened. You hear the same thing all the way up to today, 2016. This should be put side by side. Like I said, the American Slave Code, tons. I mean, it's page after page after page where white people are in total fear during this exact same time period that, oh, my God, the niggers in Haiti are going to come here and kill us. Oh, my God, the niggers in Virginia, we didn't get all of the Nat Turner crew. They're coming to get us. Oh, my God, Gabriel Price. Every other day, this is a massive motivation. Every time white people have some sort of conflict where they're bickering with other white people, 1812, when white people here are at war with white people in England, one of the first things white people in England do, hey, niggers, if you come and help us beat these white people, we will free you. We'll send you someplace else. We'll take you away. Oh, my God, they're going to take our niggers. You have white people, even when the country is at war, where white people in South Carolina, because they are massively outnumbered by black people, are saying, forget that. We can't even go fight. We got to keep an eye on our niggers. We don't have a police system. We don't have enough white people to send them off to go fight some war and make sure that our niggers don't run amok and kill us all. That is total nonsense. To sit around is a total lie. And you had ample evidence that black people were fighting back. So the only thing I would say is I would hope more of us do not allow that lie to continue to be promoted, that black people are just lames and chumps and haven't fought back. Gerald Horn has a phenomenal book. It was just published in 2014, Black Scholar, where he's talking about this exactly and pointing out some of that history of many, 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 many military efforts on the part of black people to fight back and to kill white people in order to fight and deal with slavery, and doing exactly what white people said, liberty or death, and saying that that is a total lie to even conceptualize and think that black people just didn't fight back, that we just, hey, we can't do anything about this. We'll just, you know, sing some songs and pray to Jesus that things will be better in the by and by. My question, if folks have anything else they want to get in, that's fine too. But my question, when he says historians have repeatedly confused manhood and resistance when they have written about slavery, I definitely appreciate Roz's commentary where he says just that whole paragraph where he's talking about all this and saying that he thinks the author is practicing racism, white supremacy for how this is presented. I did have some appreciation for processing that for a minute, even though, you know, I'll give my thoughts on it in a second. What do folks think about that? I'll read the sentence again. Historians have repeatedly confused manhood, and he has that in quotes, manhood and resistance when they have written about slavery. And this is in the context of talking about Joe Kilpatrick and him taking care of other black children on the plantation that were not his,
And I think he even references Charles Ball, who he's talked about repeatedly throughout the book. He's away from his family, so he adopts another black child when he moves on. It's in the context when he's talking about all that. What do people think about that sentence? Yeah, the folks that are on the line, if you have any commentary on that. Your line was breaking up a bit, Thomas. Say again.
I didn't quite get the question. Can you repeat it?
Just folks' thoughts on the sentence where he says historians have repeatedly confused manhood and resistance when they have written about slavery.
I would need a moment to think about that, Gus.
Right on. Caller in Florida, not New York. Right on.
Actually, I'm trying to find the sentence myself so I could actually look at it, because you asked a very important question, because that was one of the main things that stood out to me, too. What page was that on, Gus?
I could tell you, but I have the e-version, so it won't...
Okay, my bad. Okay, my bad. I'll try and pick it up.
Right on.
Just give me one moment.
It's in that whole section where he's talking about... Oh, go ahead, Thomas. I mean, Mr. Jeremy Ford, sorry.
Yeah, I think it was a deliberate act of racism by the author. Well, it was also an interesting point being brought up, you know, that particular thought had not, you know, been written out, you know, because you're in an impossible situation, but you know that there's some paternal feelings that is going through the minds of enslaved men, but to what depth and to what extent, you know, nobody's ever examined that when it comes to writing books about slavery.
I know. We have times where people need, you know, a moment to think. Oh, go ahead, sir.
I'm sorry. I found it. Yeah, I found that really telling, because if you look at the way white people present manhood in movies and in books and in movies, especially on the so-called silver screen. I remember Angelina Jolie did a movie about this white guy in the military who I believe he was in the Olympics, and I didn't see the movie, but I know he was captured by like Koreans, and they were basically trying to de-man him or unman him by just assaulting him and torturing him and basically telling him he was nothing. And what I find is that they said, they claim that was like her best movie as far as her directorial portfolio, and she got a lot of critical acclaim for it. And the movie is basically about him resisting this being tortured by, I don't know if it was North Korea, but I know it was an Asian country that had him in their grips. And these movies where white people show this kind of resistance, it's always tied in with their conception of manhood, because for them, their conception of manhood has a lot to do with violence, a lot to do with emasculation, sex and violence mixed together as a part of their experience with war. Chris Kyle comes to mind with that. So to me, it only makes sense that they can only see the world through one dimensional white supremacist lens and only put those two attributes together as being the central aspect of what manhood is, when we all know that it's a lot more varied than that. Like I was talking about earlier when he tried to say that having a nurturing aspect to yourself or a caring aspect to yourself is not considered a masculine trait. Of course, for white people it isn't, because that's their assilia, that is their nature. Like you said earlier, even within the family there's all kinds of chaos and you know, murder between husband and wife and so on and so forth. So they can't imagine like the lifestyle of white people versus, let's say, in the time before we had to deal with white supremacy. I could totally see, especially after reading books like The Iceman Inheritance and Yorugu, that the African family was like the complete and direct 180-degree opposite to anything that white people ever could have conceived of, because of that Dr. Cambon coined the term post-traumatic cave syndrome, I believe. And, you know, and that's what breeds that kind of dissension within the white family, where if they didn't have black people, like you said earlier, to disrespect and torture, they would try and annihilate one another like they were doing before they encountered us. And I'll mute my line there. I had something else I wanted to talk about, too, but and it kind of ties in with this, but I'll wait and give other people a chance to speak. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida, did you want to comment? I thought we had more time than we do. I guess for everybody else, Roz, and other folks, you have other commentary, just jot a note down because we do have to get to the second audio segment. But caller in Florida, did you want to respond?
I still am.
Oh, wait a minute. it was different caller in Florida. I'm sorry, ma'am. I wasn't, should have been more specific. Retired firefighter in Florida. Do you want to comment?
Oh, sorry about that.
All good.
I'll give it to the lady from Florida.
I was just going to you because I was trying to get you in because we hadn't heard from you at all. Did you want to share?
Yeah, I kind of like came on late in the reading, so I'm not going to be able to say anything directly to the first half of the reading. So let the other caller from Florida say something.
Right on. Female caller in Florida, my fault for not being specific enough. Did you want to give us our final comment before we get to the second audio segment?
No problem at all. Yes. Well, actually, I wanted to say I need more time, and I want to get the sentence. I'm missing a word. I just have historians have repeatedly, and then manhood and resistance when they've written about slavery. So what am I? What
historians
done what?
Have repeatedly confused manhood and resistance mm-hmm. when they have written about slavery.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Oh, wow.
I'll just wait, think about that some more.
Wow. I'm looking at the footnote. I didn't even think to tab. That's one thing that I can say is a major benefit if you get the electronic version. Everything that's footnoted, that's just the link. So you can just click it and it'll boop, take you right to the footnote so you can see what it is. And then you can click the footnote and it'll take you back to where you were in the book. So the footnote with that sentence, Jim Cullen, As a Man Now, Gender in African-American Men, in Darlene Clark Hine and Ernestine Jenkins, A Question of Manhood. This was published in 1999. This is just a paper. It's only like 11 pages. I could probably put my hands on that if folks were interested in reading. And then, oh, wow, there are quite a few that have been, I guess, written on this topic. I'll give you one more. The Absent Subject, African-American Masculinity and Forced Migration to the Antebellum Plantation Frontier. This is Craig T. Friend and Lori Glover in the publication Southern Manhood, Perspectives on Manhood in the Old South. The book that I mentioned, Gerald Horn, it's The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, where that is exactly what his book is about, black people who were saying liberty or death. We are going to kill as many of these racist whites as possible or die trying. That's what the whole book is about. And when I've heard him talk about it, that's why he wrote the book, because he said there's this long narrative that black people are lames and chumps and didn't fight back. And nothing could be further from the truth. My quick comment, and we can talk more about this after the second audio segment, that sentence and that whole paragraph and what he's saying. I guess my quick thought, I agree. I think that there is a totally different conception of manhood, and he does have manhood in quotes in that sentence, as well as resistance. Those are both in quotes. There's a different definition, conceptualization of manhood in terms of how whites think about and portray masculinity and manhood, and the way that I think black people, particularly black people prior to the contamination of white supremacy, conceptualized and thought of manhood. I think judging it by racist standards, it's not that you don't have black people who are behaving, conducting themselves in a manner that is what would be defined in white terms as masculinity. It's just white people consistently erase and deny those examples of masculinity. We don't want examples of Nat Turner. We don't want examples of Lavelle Mixon, who killed enforcement officers in California after Oscar Grant. We don't want that taught. That's why people don't know these individuals' names. They do a great job of erasing that. That never happened. Let's not talk about it. Mark Essex in New Orleans, who killed, said, "I'm declaring war as a result of racism, white supremacy, and I'm going after the New Orleans Police Department," and killed, I think it was 4 or 5 officers. People don't talk about that. A lot of people don't know about that because that's been deliberately suppressed. So I could add a lot more. I mean, it's quite a bit to process, and we can talk more about it in the second audio segment, but I have to get to that. Just make notes. If you did not get to share, if you had other things that you wanted to make sure that you include, we will definitely have time. Just make a note. But we're picking up. We are still in Chapter 8, The Blood. We're kind of at the tail end of Chapter 8. This is Edward Baptist. The Half Has Never Been Told, Context of White Supremacy. Thanks for all the folks for commenting. And we'll have time for more. This is the second audio segment.
So, Southern popular culture, once as open to Jewish participation as any place in Christendom, had now been cynically injected with an anti-Semitic virus that would last for many decades. But that was only the start of repudiation's poisoned gift-giving. True, reaction to the bank bonds had produced the most significant political uprising of class-based resentment to elite domination that would ever emerge from the poor and small-farming white men of the plantation frontier. No politician associated with the property banks had a viable political future. Yet GTT, on the grand scale, was a self-inflicted choking off of ties to worldwide credit markets. After this, Southwestern entrepreneurs would never again participate as equal partners in the worldwide expansion of capitalism. These elites had used popular anger to turn the power of the state into a shield against foreclosures, but at the cost of losing future control over their own credit. Common white Southerners, who had not experienced the boom of the 1830s in the same way as their self-appointed betters, cared little about all that. But credit would shape their futures, too. Repudiation of one form or another had called a white man named Pascal to a slave labor camp on the far side of the Brazos. The camp's owner, Richard Blunt, lived 20 miles away in the coastal town of Matagorda. Blunt, in debt in Mississippi, had run his slaves west across the line into Texas, where his creditors' arms were too short to reach. Pascal had come west to find a job. Overseeing paid cash. Now he had to control the people whom Blunt's decisions had separated from anything they'd built, and everyone they'd built it with, back in Mississippi. Pascal complained to the other white men in the neighborhood that the Negroes were very unruly. Perhaps the disruption of their lives had shifted the terms of the daily calculus of obeying or fighting back. Go along to get along, get yanked out of one's cabin in the middle of the night, and be herded west all over again. One's husband was back on the next plantation along the Yazoo, or one's wife and child. So were the Bible and the bag of hoarded coins, both hidden under the roots of that old cottonwood. Or maybe this. There had been that day in Mississippi when Blunt called everyone in from the field and lined them up for the man from the bank, who counted them off and wrote down dollar values and fake ages for his mortgage ledger. A mortgage is technically a sale, so by running to Texas, Blunt had stolen each mortgage slave from his or her legal owner. One day, Blunt was the representative of the law, the hard edge of a giant monolith bearing down. Then, that night, he was slipping away with stolen property. He and his agents now seemed less imposing and united. So there was Pascal, pushing a man to keep up with the cotton chopping line. And this spring day, that man had enough. He knocked Pascal in the head with a grubbing hoe and buried him in the field and plowed over him. The man took Pascal's gun and, gritting his teeth, shot himself in the hand. He staggered from the field and walked 20 miles to Matagorda, where he gave Blunt his story. Pascal had shot him in a rage, thought he killed the slave, and Pascal rode one of his horses off. Blunt was too busy with drinking and cards to worry about the details, but the story sounded fishy to his neighbor James Hawkins. A few days later, the horse came wandering back, saddle still on. Hawkins convinced other local whites to have the slaves interrogated. It was some time, he reported, before we could make the Negroes tell anything about Pascal. But they did. Hawkins took the men out to the field and made them dig Pascal's body out from under the cotton furrows. The Negro, with the hand wound, Hawkins reported, was in jail and will surely be hung. Hawkins' overseer, terrified by the neighborhood murder, was barricading himself in his cabin every night. Perhaps the terrified man couldn't erase the image, blood pooling in dirt, Pascal's shattered head half covered by the plow's first run, black man frantically whipping balking mule around for one more pass, scanning the horizon. Borrowing and slave purchases in Mississippi, a son leaving Pascal's father's home back east. These ordinary decisions had led to the death of two men on the next and maybe last frontier for cotton slavery. Murder wasn't what these men had imagined as the outcome of their long ride and march west. On slavery's bleeding edge, overly ambitious plans made years earlier led to blowback. But no one bled as much as enslaved people. And no one's life was as disrupted by the principles of GTT. From 1837 to the mid-1840s, desperately indebted enslavers looted the riches stored and nurtured by enslaved people's blood relationships. Alexander McNutt, Mississippi's repudiationist governor, had, back in 1835, purchased $20,000 worth of enslaved people from fellow Virginia native George Rust. McNutt promised to pay Rust principal plus 10% annual interest over the next several years. 10 years later, McNutt had entered and left office, and some of the 20-odd men and women who had survived the adjustment to life in his Mississippi slave labor camp had married and had children. For instance, Lewis and Mary, preteens in 1835, were now married and raising 4-year-old Anderson and toddler Louisa. Between the endless hours they spent toiling in McNutt's cotton field, Lewis and Mary had also spent years working to make sure their blood survived. But the governor had not paid Rust back. Fearing that McNutt would slip away to Texas with the slaves, the Virginia creditor demanded that the now ex-governor cash out his debt. So in May 1845, early enough that potential buyers could use them to pick that year's cotton crop, 22 survivors of the group that had come out from Virginia a decade before were auctioned. Families, new and old, were broken on the block, like the one whose 7-year-old Nathan was sold off on his own to a bidder named A.J. Paxton for $300. Another couple, Nelson and Prissy, were sold together, but their son, Jefferson, a boy of less than 10, was sold to a different buyer. Enslaved people in the southwestern states talked about the ways in which whites' decisions and failures inflicted consequences on the enslaved themselves, as if they were commodities. "He drank us up. He said, I'll put you in my pocket." If one enslaved person heard a white man and a woman in the house talking about money, everybody in the quarters understood that money meant slaves, and that slaves were about to be turned into money. "Massa say, they's money to me." They, black folks, knew that mean they, white folks, gonna sell some slaves to the next nigger trader that come round. The talk showed how well the enslaved understood the forces that structured their lives. But they experienced financial manipulation and devastation as men and women with blood pulsing in every vein. When historians have written about the role of family in the lives of the enslaved, they have talked about the way blood relationships gave structure to life, ensured care for children, even when parents were lost, and provided knowledge about the world that was a true alternative to the system of lies spun by planters. Indeed, kinship could do some of those things sometimes. Even when the early 1840s disruptions, coming after a quarter century of a growing slave trade, created a cumulative set of challenges not seen since the heyday of the Middle Passage, many adults could scramble and gamble in response to disrupted situations. And sometimes by doing so, they could protect their families. Already sold once, from Georgia to Alabama, Josiah Trellick heard that his enslaver, Charles Lynch, was in serious financial trouble and planning to sell him again. Lynch thought Trellick's abroad wife, a small, dark-skinned woman, as Lynch described her, was very homely and ignorant. But she and her child were everything to Josiah. So Trellick dug up some money he'd buried, bought a small wagon and team, and slipped away along back roads to get his family from the other enslaver who owned them. Then there was the clever light-skinned slave about whom Felix Street's stepmother told stories. This man started an impromptu auction when his owner was in the vicinity, but not paying much attention. Before anyone realized it, the white-looking slave had sold off the owner. Or there was Cynthia, a midwife in Tennessee, free but apprenticed to white guardians who skimmed off her earnings. While on a job a day's journey from the cotton labor camp where her enslaved husband lived, she consulted a fortune teller, whose cards told Cynthia that her husband's indebted owner had run him to Mississippi. The card spoke true, but luckily there was a happy ending. Her husband was stubborn and not worth much in the cotton field, and his owner was glad when Cynthia's employers made an offer to buy him. But enslavers still held the aces. A story told by one formerly enslaved person showed white folks' willingness to manipulate the powers of ownership, breaking any and every relationship, starting with bonds they gave to their creditors. "Old Cleveland," said the former slave, "takes a lot of his slaves what was in custom and brings them to Texas to sell. You know he wasn't supposed to do that, 'cause he borrowed money on you, and you's not supposed to leave the place until he paid up. Course, old Cleveland just tells the one he owed money to you had run off or expired out there." Newspapers and court documents recorded the details of how freshly reestablished blood ties in slave communities could be broken as a result of crises in white families created by the financial collapse or other factors. So-and-so's slaves, valued at $23,845, for example, went for $16,000. And African Americans remembered their own histories of the crash. In the 1930s, a white employee of the Works Progress Administration in Jasper, Texas, typed up a summary of his interview with an elderly woman named Millie Forward. "She has spent her entire life in this vicinity," he began. But the text of her interview reveals something different. "I was born in Alabama," she recalled. "Mammy have just got up from giving birth when the white folks brung us out west. Pappy's named Jim Ford and Mammy named May. They left Pappy in Alabama because he belonged to another master." That Mississippi men were untrustworthy liars may have been news to John Roberts, the debt collector, but it was not exactly a revelation to enslaved people, for whom slavery itself was stealing. But this historical epic was devastating all the same. If their first movement to the cotton frontier had brought revelation, this second one went down in enslaved people's vernacular history as a storm of chaos that swept away much of the work that survivors of the first round of disruptions had accomplished. Men had created new ways of being men, and the consequence of both women's and men's efforts coursed through children who lived, relationships that bloomed, blood ties linked in presence and remembered absence. But now, step-parents and half-siblings were split in the dark of night. And whites' mutual deceptions meant that enslaved children weren't sure about the basic facts of what had occurred. "He stole me," remembered an aged Betty Simmons, of her indebted Alabama owner who made her hide in the woods. "Then, he sell me in New Orleans so the creditors couldn't get me." In Mississippi, toddler Henri Nassez wandered every day down to the gate where he last saw his mother leaving, but he never found her. Only his sister was there to comfort him, and he was lucky to have her. "They was always fearing something terrible was going to happen, from some sign they had saw or something they had heard," Robert Laird remembered of parents and grandparents. As such children looked back from old age, they sometimes felt that these secondary forced migrations during the decade of planter disaster had isolated and atomized them, stealing their optimism and teaching them the devastating lesson that their blood ties could be broken into unknowable pieces. One Louisiana ex-slave told the tale he had heard of Pierre Auquan, who was sold by his mother's owner at the age of 2. Years later, when freedom came, Auquan married a woman named Tamarind. The couple had 3 children. One day, his regular barber was unavailable, so he sat down and Tamarind got out the scissors. As she stood behind him, cutting it close to the scalp, she saw something she had never before noticed. "You know, Pierre, this scar on the back of your head sets me a-thinking way back when I was a gal. I had a little brother then. The master sold my little brother from us, and 5 years later, they sold me from my ma and pa. Since then, I ain't seen none of my folks." Tamarind continued, not yet realizing what she was saying. One day, my little brother and me was playing, and he hit me and hurt me. I took an oyster shell and cut him on the back of his head, right where you got that scar. In their quest to make something beautiful, two people who had lost their personal and family histories stumbled terribly over the shards of the past. And variations of this brother and sister story appear several times in the Works Progress Administration interviews. In each case, the storyteller is saying, listen, enslaver-generated chaos could ultimately, if it went on long enough, steal one's capacity to recognize even one's closest kin. If you didn't know your family, you didn't know yourself. And if you didn't know yourself, what sort of disasters could you bring down on yourself and others? So history taught orphan children to hold such fears alongside all their bravery. Adult survivors of White's financial disaster saw their own new lives, built through the practice of ordinary virtues to each other and through the rebuilding of ties of blood, ripped apart again. They found themselves alone, bearing another set of survivor scars. This did not agree with the picture of Southern African Americans as a traditional people comforted by a deep and resilient web of kinship. Yet it is precisely what happened to people whose family trees had been clear-cut. Despite their stinging defeats, Southwestern entrepreneurs who had been through previous crises knew how to survive a downturn. Slave property was mobile, self-supporting, more liquid than any store of value short of sterling bills, and perhaps the most attractive kind of collateral in the entire Western world. If they could keep possession of their slaves, they could take advantage of those elements of enslaved property, especially if new geographical expansion convinced investors to lend their credit, as they always had before, to entrepreneurially minded planters. And yet, even with all of those reasons to feel confidence in the future after 1839, as external pressures from abolitionist critics and Northern creditors began to increase, a growing number of Southern politicians and voters began to show clear symptoms of a deepening siege mentality. A small group of Northern congressmen, most notably John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts and Joshua Giddings of Ohio, repeatedly introduced anti-slavery petitions to test Congress's gag rule. Although their measures failed, the Northern radicals slowly opened cracks in the interregional alliances between Southern slavery expanders and Northern expansion enablers that were the essence of both the Whig and Democratic parties. Meanwhile, the 1840 U.S. Census showed that high population growth in the free states was erasing the slave states' ability to control the House. Reapportionment would give Northern Whigs and Democrats less reason to do what Southerners demanded. The only obvious hope for increasing the number of Southerners in Congress was to add Texas. But after Jackson maneuvered the government into recognition of the Lone Star Republic's independence in 1837, the Whig Party had blocked its annexation. Texas annexation looked dead, and there were other problems too. International pressures, generated by Britain, also threatened future expansion, thus imperiling slavery's survival. In 1834, Parliament, persuaded by powerful bureaucrats who insisted that free labor would prove more efficient than slave labor, imposed emancipation in all the empire's far-flung domains. Still, Southern enslavers might have taken comfort in the fact that even as Britain freed 700,000 Caribbean slaves, slavery continued to expand, not only in the United States, where statehood was on the docket for Arkansas and Florida, but in two other places, Cuba and Brazil. Between 1810 and 1840, Cuba had taken the lead in world sugar markets, underselling sugar producers on the far less efficient British islands. Meanwhile, Brazil's coffee plantations expanded at an astronomical rate, feeding the world market's soaring demand for caffeine. In contrast to the United States, however, internal trades were insufficient to supply the needs of enslaver entrepreneurs on Cuba's and Brazil's frontiers of production. Instead, in almost every year of the 1830s, slave traders carried between 80,000 and 100,000 enslaved Africans across the Atlantic to Havana and Rio de Janeiro. 3 decades after the much-ballyhooed closing of the Anglo-American Middle Passage, and in violation of existing treaties signed by Spain and Brazil, the open wound in Africa's side was flowing faster than ever. In 1840, British Prime Minister Robert Peel began to push other European nations to accept a treaty called the Convention of London. This agreement would allow the Royal Navy to search and seize ships flying non-British flags if they were suspected of participating in the Atlantic slave trade. The British had already extended this kind of pressure to Texas, which, in return for diplomatic recognition from Britain, had agreed to allow the Royal Navy to stop ships bringing slaves from Cuba to Texas. And actual enforcement of existing treaties banning the Atlantic slave trade would threaten slavery's viability in Brazil and Cuba. Enforcement would also eviscerate the profits that U.S. citizens were making from the illegal trade. U.S. mercantile firms invested indirectly in slaving voyages to present-day Angola and Nigeria. Slave ships often employed captains from the United States. Many such vessels flew the Stars and Stripes, because British ships were reluctant to strong-arm vessels sailing under that flag. North American shipbuilding firms sold 64 ships in Rio between 1841 and 1845, most of them for the slave trade. In 1842, Britain sent Lord Ashburton, a.k.a. Alexander Baring, one of the directors of Baring Brothers, as an ambassador to the United States. His mission was to secure U.S. submission to the terms of the Convention of London. Cynics pointed out that the British Empire's sugar producers, comparatively disadvantaged by the parliamentary abolition, would benefit from removing Cuban and Brazilian competition. On first glance, small revenue gains in sugar would hardly seem to balance out the losses that Britain, whose economy depended on an endless supply of cheap, high-quality cotton, might suffer by blocking the further expansion of U.S. slavery. But British politicians wanted to win the votes of reforming evangelicals, who saw worldwide abolition of slavery as a moral goal. Moreover, the recently demonstrated ability of U.S. planters to leverage British dependence on their cotton into credit bubbles and financial crises worried British industrial cities. British chambers of commerce petitioned Parliament to incentivize the growth of Indian cotton. Indian peasants had not been able to stand up to competition from southwestern slaves, but in the early 1840s, the British colonial government launched experimental farms across western India. They hired 12 American men who claimed to be southern planters and cotton experts. If Indian cotton failed, an independent Texas might be the solution, freeing British industry from dependence on U.S. planters. Texas land, claimed British agents there, will yield three times as much cotton as the Carolinas or Georgia to the acre. And even as Lord Ashburton arrived in Washington, British agents were trying to convince Lone Star citizens to remain outside of the United States. Had Daniel Webster or John Quincy Adams been making foreign policy, slavery's expansion in the New World might have been definitively halted in 1842. Instead, many Southeastern enslavers were in the process of turning U.S. foreign policy into an engine that would drive the slave South's further growth. One was President John Tyler himself, whom Whig critics, resentful of his activity to undermine their program, had taken to calling his accidency. Taylor replaced pro-Convention of London appointees and cabinet members, such as Webster, who resigned, with fanatically pro-slavery men, including the new Secretary of State, Abel P. Upshur. Like Tyler, Upshur was a planter from one of the oldest counties of eastern Virginia. Although Upshur was the author of arcane constitutional writings that insisted, like early 1830s nullifiers, on the separate sovereignty of the individual states, once inside the executive branch, he showed no compunction about using centralized power to advance expansionist enslavers' particular agenda. Despite the fact that the Senate had the power to approve or reject treaties negotiated by the executive branch, and that the Senate's Whig majority opposed Texas annexation, Upshur and Tyler were determined to see slavery's expansion resume. They began negotiations with the Texas government, and Upshur plotted a strategy that would allow the executive branch to sneak an annexation through Congress. They simply had to figure out how to present annexation as an imperative to two groups: slaveholders, who feared an end to expansion, and American nationalists, who feared British interference. Southerners of both parties and the northern wing of one party would then cooperate and annex slaveholding Texas. While Tyler foolishly believed that annexation would convince either the Whigs or the Democratic Party to nominate him for the presidency in 1844, Upshur was actually acting on stage managing letters from another politician, one who also wanted to use the Texas question to make himself the champion and candidate of all who supported national expansion. This secret director was John C. Calhoun. He owned more than 100 slaves, as well as gold mines in Georgia and the Fort Hill labor camp in South Carolina, now the site of Clemson University, and he had once been the Nationalist Secretary of War under President James Monroe. Supporting anti-nationalist nullification, Calhoun had spoken for the fears of declining South Carolina's enslavers rather than to the needs of migrating entrepreneurs. But new realities had made Calhoun rethink his point of view. These included both the flood of petitions that allowed abolitionism to seep into congressional business and his now intimate experience with the ongoing project of expanding slavery's frontiers. His son Andrew had driven dozens of forced migrants to a new slave labor camp in Alabama, and now he and John together were trying to bring their family fortunes successfully through the broader storm of indebtedness. Calhoun would spend the remainder of his life as the greatest slavery expansionist in the United States, providing both the theory and the practical political maneuvers that would allow enslavers to launch another wave of creation and destruction. A student's first encounter with Calhoun often comes in the form of a daguerreotype from Calhoun's last years. Look it up. His eyes glare robotically at the student, his face set like that of an undead despot, skeletal from the tuberculosis that was killing him. The student hears about nullification and listens to quotations from unpublished disquisitions found in Calhoun's papers after death. The quotations contain impossible abstractions, such as the suggestion that the United States should shift to a two-person executive, one Northern president and one Southern, who could each veto the other, or veto Congress if he liked. By the time the professor ties the lecture off with language about the supposedly anti-modern, inefficient nature of the slaveholder economy, the student has received the complete image of Calhoun as, at best, the Hector of a Troy fated to fall, to quote abolitionist Wendell Phillips, the champion of an inevitably to be defeated Southern ruling class. Calhoun ought to have known, the conventional story suggests, that the South would lose in the struggle for economic, political, and eventually military predominance. Maybe so, but enslavers were very powerful. The idea that slavery would inevitably end is less incontrovertible once we recognize the dynamism of their economy. Even if they struggled in the early 1840s, enslavers knew how to revive dynamic growth with more expansion. The theories that Calhoun was developing to justify further expansion were actually modern, tailored to a market economy that saw economic entities as people, that measured people as factors of production, and whose most innovative actors believed that entrepreneurs should be able to wield private property without restraint. In the meantime, however, he was also an adroit practical politician who was about to maneuver the nation into following his particular entrepreneurial minorities program. For when Upshur died in a freak February 1844 accident aboard a U.S. naval vessel in the Potomac, Tyler invited Calhoun to become the new Secretary of State. Going through Upshur's correspondence, Calhoun found a letter that Britain's new ambassador, Richard Pakenham, had delivered. Speaking for the British government, the letter informed the Tyler administration that Her Majesty would object to the annexation of Texas, and that Great Britain desires and is constantly exerting herself to procure the general abolition of slavery throughout the world. Sensing opportunity, Calhoun wrote a response, sending a copy of both his and Pakenham's messages to the Senate, whose Whig majority had recently blocked a proposed treaty of annexation suggested by Tyler and Upshur. This Pakenham letter was Calhoun's devious ploy to force both voters and politicians to choose either to support British interference or add more slavery territory to the United States. After criticizing British meddling in Texas, Calhoun insisted that slavery was not only expedient, but the best thing for black people. Statistics from the 1840 federal census supposedly proved that a high proportion of free African Americans in the North were insane. So, experience has proved that slavery must be the proper state for people of African descent. If Britain wanted to end slavery in its own dominions, that was its problem. But Britain had no business keeping Texas out of the United States, for submission to British meddling would inflict calamity, freedom, on the race which it is the avowed object of her exertions to benefit. Calhoun believed that most Northern whites were nationalist and racist, and indeed, many Northern Democrats were both, as well as deeply pro-annexation, such as Illinois Congressman Stephen Douglas, an ardent supporter of national expansion whose platforms usually featured extensive race baiting, or John L. O'Sullivan, editor of the pro-expansionist Democratic Review, who coined the term manifest destiny to describe what he saw as the white U.S. citizens' God-given right to take the remainder of North America from Indians and mixed-race Mexicans. But Calhoun's letter was a piece of bad behavior that aggravated many other people as well, even provoking Southern Whigs to help kill Tyler's Texas Treaty when it finally came up for a Senate vote. Ultimately, the letter's open insistence that the expansion of slavery was a good thing put each major party's frontrunner to the test, and then destroyed their candidacies. Democratic frontrunner Martin Van Buren released a public letter that backed away from annexation, killing his chances of winning Southern support for one more presidential run. Henry Clay, the clear leader among the potential Whig candidates, released a similar document. The Whigs had already made anti-annexation their party line, so Clay easily collected their nomination. But he had laid up trouble for the fall. The Democratic Convention, however, played out along the fracture lines Calhoun had struck. A pro-annexation forces, some Southern, some expansionist Northerners who followed Douglas and Red O'Sullivan, seized control of the Rules Committee and changed the process to require a two-thirds majority for nominating a presidential candidate. Once the balloting began, Van Buren could not convince enough Southern delegates to get his vote to the required two-thirds. The convention settled on James K. Polk, Tennessee protege of Andrew Jackson, former Speaker of the House of Representatives, and indebted owner of dozens of slaves and several Mississippi labor camps. An alleged moderate who had stood by the party through the panic years, he seemed to be the second best choice for all factions. Polk promised not only to add Texas to the Union, but also to demand most of what is today British Columbia in his negotiations with the British over the Oregon Territory's border with Canada. After the Democrats wrote double expansion into their platform, the South, plus Northern expansionists, faced off against Northerners who opposed annexation. The Democrats pummeled Clay with his anti-annexation letter. He faced a relentless series of attacks, like the one launched by Mississippi Senator Robert Walker, he of the Groves versus Slaughter advocacy of the idea that enslavers could repudiate what they owed. Walker, who owned lots of Texas land, wrote a pamphlet aimed at the northern market, claiming that the expansion of U.S. authority into Texas would actually reduce the scope and lifespan of slavery, the old diffusion trick again. Walker presented a very different argument in a South-marketed pamphlet called The South in Danger, which depicted Clay as the tool of anti-slavery Northern Whigs. When the election was held, Polk lost some of the non-cotton Southern states. Plus, by a mere 133 votes, his home state of Tennessee. But he made a clean sweep of the cotton states, many of the states north of the Ohio and west of the Appalachians, and the highly populous states of Virginia and Pennsylvania. The anti-slavery Liberty Party probably tipped the New York election to Polk by taking votes from Clay. Although Polk led Clay by only 1.5% in the total national popular vote, his expansionism won enough key states to give him a substantial electoral college majority of 170 to Clay's 105. Calhoun's ingenious strategy of maximizing the confrontation with Britain and asserting the racist case for slavery as a positive good had split the Whig Party in half, producing victory for a Southern expansionist. Even before the election, land prices in Texas, anticipating Polk's victory, had begun to rise. National financial markets, meanwhile, anticipated that the federal government would annex Texas and pay off the Lone Star Republic's bonds at full face value, once Polk took office. Tyler, however, did not want to leave the credit for Polk, So when the lame duck Congress gathered in December 1844, he told it that the American people had recorded a mandate for expansion. Annexation by treaty had failed, so Tyler suggested a fine print measure called a joint resolution that would require a simple majority in each house. The constitutionality was suspect, but surprisingly, Tyler and Calhoun did not bring up their usual strict interpretation principles. In January 1845, the House passed a resolution admitting Texas and accepting its bonds, its slavery, and its more than 300,000 square miles, which were to be divided into as many as four slave states. One of the crucial switch votes that put annexation over the top in the Senate was that of Ohio's Benjamin Tappan. Though his brothers were Lewis and Arthur Tappan, abolitionism's wealthiest supporters, Benjamin had major Texas bond holdings. The outgoing president, refusing to wait for Polk, immediately signed annexation into law. Thus, in the last 2 years of Tyler's accidental term, enslavers committed the momentum of the federal government and the Democratic's core constituencies, even though Tyler was ostensibly a Whig, to a specific vector of national expansion. This vector, by the realities of geography, would inevitably privilege territorial growth on the southern side of the Missouri Compromise line.
And that will do it. I'm pretty sure that we are going to be all done in two. I guess it could be three, but maybe three. I guess maybe. We'll say three. Yeah, we should be done in three. So we'll have three more of these, and we'll be all done after next week. With that, if you have comments you would like to share, the number again is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Certainly, if folks have thoughts on the sentence that we ended with, the first audio segment, I'll say, we can make time for that as well. So, Thomas in New York, Roz, Misunderstanding in Florida, retired firefighter, and Mr. Demery 4, all of you should be with us. If there are other folks who have comments, you should get your hand up now. Feel free to chime in.
Okay. This is Misunderstanding. I was only female on the call. First thing I want to say is, I'll just mention Mr. And hopefully I'm saying it right, Josiah Trellick, for that stood out to me. Just displaying a high level of self-respect and perseverance to save his wife, or to get his wife, I'll say, from the other slave owner. Let me see what else stood out to me. And Gus, I'm still going to need time to think about that sentence, definitely. Severely victimized, multitasking while thinking, and a bit hard. But let's see what else stood out here. Well, still continued violence, of course, probably going to be the theme. With that type of behavior, right now that's all I have, not much. Don't have the book, so I'm kind of like using some listening and comprehension skills. But if I could think of anything else, I will chime in. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure, for sure. Other folks who dialed in, you should be with us as well.
Yes, good greetings, everyone. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm going to attempt to comment on the question. It's going to be kind of like similar to what I think I heard you say. The system of racism, white supremacy, is when it comes to the subject of manhood or even womanhood, they're not going to train us. They're not going to train us. They understand that it's deeply connected with self-respect also. It's, to me, it's almost like one and the same, you know, manhood and self-respect. And in turn, the adjectives will come along the way, such as resisting person who has achieved manhood will resist any harm that's done to him or her or the people that they care about. So they're not going to give any assistance at all. What I've noticed even today is primarily through the imagery of today, they would go to a certain level. And basically what I see it says, well, this is the limitations that we're going to put on you into the subject of manhood. And it's mixed with it's sometimes with the same non-white black person, you will see in the next movie or so some deep level of femininity out of that same person, which gives a very mixed message. I hope I'm clear on what I'm stating on that. That is something that we're going to have to redefine and even define it different from what it was before this period of time, before the system of racist white supremacy. Because apparently if whatever that was found before the system of racist white supremacy, it wasn't enough to stop it from happening. So that is a tremendous work in progress. The whole idea of manhood and or resisting. Manifested destiny. Every time I hear that word, I cringe, because some of the most devastating maneuvers or activities of racism, white supremacy took place under that title. My layman's meaning to it is, I'm white, this is how things are supposed to be done, and no one else input is important, and I'm about the means of destroying what needs to be destroyed and taking over what needs to be taken over, and it's to my best self-interest that everything that I say and do would be about. I actually learned something that, because the first time I thought it took place as a word with action was actually in Africa. But what it teaches me is that it reinforces anyway that the system of racist white supremacy is global, because this word was used, this particular word is being used in this book. That means it is in this part of the world, but we all know through history that word was used, I believe, with Cecil Rhodes. I could be wrong, but I do know it was used in Africa. And action took place with that combination word. Very, very dreadful and to the highest incorrectness was done under that double word. Thank you.
Yes, sir, I'll be heard.
Yes, sir.
Okay. First, I'd like to say that a lot of this forced migration, as the author states, or stealing, as the enslaved Africans termed it, you know, has a significant impact upon African Americans and the descendants of the enslaved black people. And I want to comment about the the guy Pascal, who needed a job and went to work for this guy Blunt. And Blunt was in debt and probably hiding from his those collectors. But anyway, the book described how the enslaved person, you know, being snatched from his cabin, lost all control, you know, of anything concerning, you know, his own life or anything that he's built. And this guy pushing him, you know, harder and harder. And it's, he just snapped. So he hit him in the back of the head with this hoe and buried him. You know, and I think, you know, that shows that a human being has a breaking point. You can push somebody to the very edge of sanity or reality because, you know, when the guy, when he killed him, he buried him, kept on plowing. But then he went and told the owner, you know, some story. And, of course, the end was like it always is. The black person was hanged. The other part, you know, when they mentioned that whites were always holding the aces. So it didn't matter if, you know, they owed all this debt, they were complaining and fighting over whether to annex Texas or not, you know, and basically to expand slavery. So there was absolutely no thought given to any rights of black people. They were just concerned about expanding slavery and continuing to accumulate wealth at the expense of black people. Now I'll mute my line on that. Thanks.
Other folks have commentary that we have not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings. I remember there was something relating to the question that you had asked about that particular line that I wanted to touch on before, and it was from page 283 to 284. It says, like Hawkins Wilson, who wrote from Texas to the sister from whom he'd been separated as a little boy, to tell her that he'd survived to become a grown man, and that, like Joseph, he would be overjoyed to see her again. Hannibal was patriarch and mother hen, both. He measured himself by what he had lost, he had endured, and what he had found again, and not by what he had been unable to resist from enslavers who had called him a boy. What such men got by surviving and caretaking was not always enough to replace the other hopes that they held in their hearts. They paid a psychological cost that no one can measure. Nor were all the enslaved men exemplars of ordinary virtue, but Joe Kilpatrick, Jack Hannibal, and uncounted others chose to shelter under their wings far off futures that might only arrive long after their own deaths. They hoped that in the future children or children's children, their own blood, would be free. For this future to arrive, however, someone had to survive. In a billion acts of quiet love that kept children and others alive, such men have been challenging Southern white and Western definitions of manhood, even as the boom in planter power swelled. And that paragraph I found to really speak directly to what you were talking about. And when he wrote the sentence that said they paid a psychological cost no one could measure, it's just really, it really speaks to the fact that none of us qualify for mental health as black people, and that we really have to become as empathetic as possible to the way that we express ourselves due to the torture that we go through and have gone through for the last 500 years. And it also made me think about, there was a documentary on silverback gorillas in the Congo, and they had discussed the fact that poachers had killed so many, or basically such a high percentage of the females off in the Congo during the conflicts that they had there, that for the first time in them studying gorillas since it was like the mid-19th century, they started to see homosexual tendencies in the male gorillas. And it was due to the lack of access to viable females. And they talked about the type of affection that they saw, that the older males would show to the younger males and caretaking. Basically, some of them would play the role of a female due to the fact that there were no females around. And it made me think of the fact when he talked about the psychological costs, just the damage that it does to a man's psyche to not be able in any way, shape, or form to express yourself as a man or be a head of a household or to provide for your family just is devastating to the psyche of any male. And for us, just forget it. I mean, we've been suffering under that for quite a long time. And in reference to the unnamed ancestor that basically took his life into his own hands by killing Pascal, I just laud him. Whoever he is, I will definitely send up a prayer for him and at least put some semblance of who he is on my ancestral altar to pay him his respects, because it was just amazing. And I found that in the second paragraph when they talked about the overseer, they said, perhaps terrified, the man could not erase the image, blood pooling in the dirt, Pascal's shattered head half covered by the plow's first run. I mean, it was just, to me, it was just an amazing thing to I mean, sadly, he ended up the way all Africans who assert themselves and take their black self-respect into their own hands end up. But it's really true what I believe it was the firefighter from Florida said, that you can, you know, push somebody but so far before they react and they, you know, they're going to do something about it and not really care about losing their lives in the process of doing so. And I found there was a passage on 294 that was very telling. It said, enslaved people in the southwestern states talked about the ways in which whites' decisions and failures inflicted consequences upon the enslaved themselves, as if they were commodities. He drank us up, he said. I'll put you in my pocket. If one enslaved person heard a white man and a woman in the house talking about money, everybody in the quarters understood that money meant slaves and that slaves were about to be turned into money. Master say, they's money to me. They, black folks, knew that they mean white folks are going to sell some slaves to the next nigga trader that come around. And this really, to me, informs the way that white people look at us today. To go back to the term bucks again. But in reality, if you look at all 10 areas of people activity, that's exactly what we are to them. And just the way all of these different things function together to bolster the entire system of racism, white supremacy, also add to the fact that anti-blackness is really the engine of the whole thing, really just goes to show that this is what they still think of us as to this very day. And there was a sentence on page 298 that I found very telling. He said in that sentence, 3 decades after the much ballyhooed closing of the Anglo-American Middle Passage and in violation of existing treaties signed by Spain and Brazil, the open wound in Africa's side was flowing faster than ever. And I've always thought about white people as a parasitic, vampiric, cancerous, anthropomorphic cancer, essentially is what I look at them as. And that sentence really tells the way he describes it so viscerally, that they opened the wound in Africa's side and it was flowing faster than ever, to me just signifies the sucking of the lifeblood of Africa from the people to the resources. I mean, you name it, just blood sucking. And I just found his use of that particular simile or metaphorical term was very telling, because it really speaks to the psychopathology of white people. And then after criticizing British meddling in Texas, Calhoun insisted that slavery was not only expedient, but the best thing for black people. Statistics from the 1840 census supposedly proved that a high proportion of free African Americans in the North were insane. So experience has proved that slavery must be the appropriate state for people of African descent. And that, to me, speaks of the prison industrial complex and just the housing of black bodies for free labor, basically as slaves, in the system of racism, white supremacy. And it made me think of growing up in Brooklyn in the 80s and 90s, how a lot of the guys around me looked at jail as like a rite of passage. Thank goodness I didn't, because I wasn't, you know, I was at that point, my parents were taking me to see historians like Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark and a ton of other people. So I had a different mentality, but a lot of the young people around me had that mentality. And it kind of speaks to that experience to me today. And then also the last thing I wanted to talk about was, weirdly enough, you always talk about things not being a coincidence, Gus. I was reading the book by Dr. Ben called From African Captives to Insane Slaves, and I actually came across a section in which they talk about the fact that American cotton was actually, they used hybridized cotton whose foundation came from Africa with the black people who came to America long before Columbus. So I found it so telling that those Africans who those pre-Columbian Africans that came to America and brought cotton with them had no idea that generations later, cotton would be one of the driving engines of the enslavement of their descendants. And I'll mute my line there. Thank you very much.
Sure. Did we miss anybody? Anybody on the line who has not shared? Anybody who has not shared?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I had, I wanted to answer the question. First, I wanted to answer the question from last week. I think enslaved women could have possibly positioned themselves better on the plantation. For this week's question, what I think is, anytime white people talk about manhood and equate it to blacks and fighting back, it's a huge act of racism on the part of the white people, because they know that black people are under the gun. And, you know, honestly, a fight, or be it physically or genetically, they know they would lose. So if you look at that time of slavery, you know, if a white man could punch a black man in the face, and that black man knows if he swings back, or if he even tries to block the punch, there was a passage where this runaway slave had the dog fighting him, and the master said, you know, if you even swing at some dogs, I'm going to shoot you right here. So he had to let the dogs bite him. You know, it's a uneven fight, not a just fight. And then to sit back and call someone a punk because they let it happen to them, even though you knew they were under the threat of the gun, is a huge act of racism. And also, white people could go get other whites, you know, form a lynch mob. You know, black people didn't have that power. And I think that any time someone calls, you know, a chump or something because of that, and that under those conditions, is definitely a huge act of racism if that person's white. And I'm out of my mind, thank you.
For sure. Got both of the questions last week and this week. Anybody that we missed? Anybody who has not shared at all? I think we got Roz, Thomas in New York, retired fighter. I think we might have got everybody. I'll get in some of my quick thoughts. Just where it starts off with a black male killing a white man, bashing in his skull. Basically, from
muted.
Oops.
Unmuted.
Whoops, hit the wrong button there. Just the second audio segment beginning with a white man getting his skull bashed in, where a black person just couldn't take it anymore, just for me, further evidence that any conversation where it's, you know, black people in such a tough position, they couldn't resist, this sort of thing was happening all the time. And even when that wasn't happening directly, which it was, whites were constantly talking in fear of this happening, or even something way worse, where you're having mass, where it's not just one individual person saying, I can't take it anymore and I'm going to kill this white person, but large slave revolt, hundreds of black people coming to kill racist enslavers. So for me, and it, like I said, it goes back to the original point, I think, where you said at the very beginning that black people didn't revolt, that there were surprisingly few rebellions, and then where he said a little bit later that most of the free black people
that they were loyal to whites in time of crisis, where I challenged both of those and saying I'm not sure that that's accurate, and that just could be him practicing racism. Anywho, also thought it was, let's see, where he says, and even before the killing, where he says Pascal complained that the Negroes were very unruly. That to me right there also suggests that this is just long running in terms of whether you want to call it resistance, manhood, womanhood, that this has been greatly minimized, where you get Gone with the Wind, where you get the help, that black people were just happy and docile, that there has been long-running racism, white supremacy to depict that black people were not resisting, not being unruly, not killing whites, poisoning them, and, you know, whatever else you can think of in terms of resistance. Yes, where he says Hawkins, overseer, terrified by the neighborhood murder, was barricading himself in his cabin every night. You have story after story after story of this, of white people in total fear. I already mentioned Nat Turner. This is depicted in Roots, of white people fear that black people are going to figure out, do the correct thing, have some black self-respect, and take Patrick Henry's line, freedom or death. Joshua Josiah Trellick, I think, misunderstanding it, pointed that out as well, him working to get his family and his wife and children to get them back. Outstanding act of black self-respect right there. When he's talking about Texas, he mentions specifically Jasper, Texas, where they're talking to an informer, a formerly enslaved black person. This is in the 20th century, and he's talking about how he was born in Alabama, and then his, you know, no-count racist owner got in trouble, and he ended up being in Texas. Jasper, Texas, just pause for James Byrd Jr. Folks remember that. Continued white savagery. The whole point about the annexation of Texas and just bringing in more land for enslavement, no surprise, calculated, I think, racist, their whole plan of what they call manifest destiny. We're just going to take and take and take as much as possible, and this will be more opportunity for us to use our niggers to make even more money. That explicit detail about all this in American, the American Slave Coast, which we'll be talking about on Monday, where he's talking about John C. Calhoun and their effort to get this property into the Union. Thought it just further displayed white people are not ignorant about racism. And I've said this consistently, whether we're talking 1800s, 21st century, white people, they know if you're white, you're supposed to be racist, which is the exact logic that John C. Calhoun employs to get Texas into the Union. I know white people in the North, even if they don't, quote unquote, own slaves, I know that they're racist white supremacists. So I'll just use that to my advantage and how I put my argument together, that we need to get this piece of property so we can, you know, continue using our niggers and getting this money. I guess where he says that the black people in the North were insane, there's lots of this, where you hear this sort of racist rhetoric, which I would just use that again, where he says that free black people were loyal to whites that were not in times of slavery. I would cite this as an example. I find that hard to believe when you're hearing things like this, when they have the American Colonization Society, where they're saying, hey, we just need to get rid of you all, send you to Liberia or find someplace. Y'all can go down to Haiti and hang out with your brothers down there. I just find that very hard to believe when you're getting this sort of racist rhetoric from whites on a constant basis, that free black people would be, quote unquote, loyal to whites, particularly in a time of crisis. Where he says, indeed, many northern whites, in my view, that should be all that was a pattern. I would think if you're a white person anywhere, really anywhere in the world, but if we're talking exclusively about the United States, if you're a white person and you do not believe in the practice of racism, white supremacy, you would have been in the what they call minority. You would have been, I think Dr. Cambon's term, statistically insignificant, where they had a formal enslavement in the North. They certainly had racism, white supremacy, widespread. Didn't matter where you were, New York, Illinois, New England, Pennsylvania, wherever you happen to be at in the quote-unquote North. In fact, it reminds me of our guest
Katrina Brown. She was on the program back in 2010, January, about 6 years ago, 2010. She was on the North Side of Slavery, where her family, they were in the North. I forget the exact location. I think it was someplace in New England, but this is a PBS documentary. You all can check it out. But where she talks about her family, the Brown family, they were like the biggest slave owners ever. They have all this material family heirlooms where they have shackles where they've tortured black people, and all the manifests from black people that they bought, stole, sold, just the whole nine. So, I mean, just a little bit of minimization, I would say, in that sentence. Anything else I want to make sure I get in before we wrap? We did our 3 hours. I'm pretty sure I can leave it there. We can just pick up for next week. Misunderstanding, do you have anything you wanted to get in before we wrap? I saw you had, I guess you hung up and then you dialed back in with a hand up. Do you have something you wanted to get in before we wrap the program up?
Thank you. Hold on a minute. Yeah, I'm having some phone issues. So.
Your volume is pretty low. Your volume is low, if you could speak up.
Oh, man. Having phone issues. Is that a little bit better?
A little better. Just lots of black self-respect. Speak up as much as you can.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I wanted to, just point out that I think that it could have been a deliberate act of racism on Mr. Baptiste's part by not mentioning the black male, that his name, that basically hit the one of the slave owners in the head. Let me see what else. Also, I think it was in the first portion where Mr. Devereaux was talking about Mrs. Devereaux was just getting unruly and she had tendencies to beat the slaves, et cetera. The writer was basically portraying that as if that was something abnormal, based on just Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, Moja, just some of the accounts that they have in that book about, you know, how these white women would, you know, just have ridiculous acts of just racism, rampant, stepping on infants' heads, and I just thought that was an act of racism. That's the only thing I wanted to point out. Thank you for allowing me to share.
For sure. That's in 12 Years a Slave, the book and the film. That's another one from our book study session where the tyranny of white women mauling and maiming black people. And I think one of the key things that we pointed out, the distinction between those two works, where the book, 12 Years a Slave, there is another black person. It's not Solomon Northrup, but there's another black person who's been enslaved. And he says, I can't take it anymore. And he takes a hatchet and kills the white man. But they do not put that in the movie, where I said that exactly what I've been saying the whole time, that white people deliberately leave that sort of thing out. And then they will come back and lie and say, oh, yeah, you all are chumps and lames and you all just haven't revolted, when they have skillfully, deliberately deleted that from the history books. And Joan Little, because it hasn't just been a black male thing, Joan Little, who was, this is in the 60s, where some racist enforcement officer was going to rape her and she took an ice pick and killed him. She ended up being exonerated, where they said she absolutely had the right to defend herself and she was found not guilty of murder. But this was in the late 1960s. This is recent history, where this is another one. They're not going to put images of her, or as I said before, Lavelle Mixon, Colin Ferguson, Nkosi Thondaway. This is 2011. He killed a lot of white people because of racism in Georgia. It's tons. It's more examples than you could think of. As I said, Mark Essex before, they're not going to put these individuals up and say, yes, these are black people that we want you to emulate and make sure that you know. We want to make sure that everybody in schools knows about these individuals. That is not what they're going to do under the system of racism, white supremacy. They're going to give you Uncle Tom's Cabin, Gone with the Wind, The Help. That's the image that they want. That's what they have projected of black people, as opposed to images of black resistance, black self-respect, black strength. With that, we will be here tomorrow, compensatory call-in. Looking forward to hearing observations, workplace racism, catching up on what's gone down the last 7 days, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here Sunday as well, broadcasting live with the ball game. We will be rebroadcasting one of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's previous visits during the Super Bowl. Right now, I think I'm leaning towards her 2010 visit just because that's older, and I suspect a lot of folks that are listening now have not heard or might not have heard that program as opposed to when she was with us more recently for the Super Bowl. But that'll be this Sunday. We should be here Monday, as I said, book that strongly coincides with this one. Even if you haven't read the book, just having read this, you should be able to participate and get some interesting information. The Sublets, Ned Sublet and his wife, they wrote The American Slave Coast, really focusing on slavery as a breeding industry in this area of the world and deliberately, consciously a breeding, raping industry. They'll be here on Monday. White couple, his white wife will be with us too Monday evening. And then we should have Bob Law back with us on Wednesday to discuss the passing of Maurice White, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and how that relates to racism, white supremacy, what that group was attempting to do with their music to work against racism, white supremacy. Bob Law, he's been on the program before, documentary filmmaker. He's hosted his own radio broadcast. He was with us last year, I believe, in the spring of 2015. Great information about the history of black music, black entertainment, and efforts to work against racism, white supremacy, and how racists have, like everything else, co-opted it and taken it to just use it to further strengthen and support racism, white supremacy. I think one of his big ideas was that we thought whites were interested in black music for money, whereas they were using it to promote ideas, concepts, racist ideas, racist concepts. But very much looking forward to hearing from Bob Law again in relation to Maurice White, who passed away yesterday, one of the influential musicians of the past 50 years, and his work with Earth, Wind, and Fire. If you have problems, gripes, complaints, suggestions, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, we'll be back tomorrow. Sobriety would be best under conditions of war. Buckle up if you're going to be behind the wheel. Definitely no alcohol. Do not be around others who are intoxicated. Let's do everything we can to make the best possible decisions to solve this problem ASAP. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.